Meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. It's Thursday, March 29th, 2012. We have a full agenda today, and we are going to start with Senate File 2577, the Omnibus Bonding Bill. Senator Senjum, welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for having us here this morning. We're kind of getting our act together. I have Madam Chair and members, Julian Plowman, who is the committee administrator for the capital bonding program here in the Senate. Obviously, Stephanie James from Nonpartisan Council, and Dave Jensen, the fiscal analyst for nonpartisan staff. Madam Chair and members, the bill before you is the 2012 edition of the Senate Capital Investment Committee, and it is a $496 million bill. It is broken down in general ways accordingly: $179 million for higher education, that's 36% of the bill. State asset preservation at $125 million, which is about 25% of the bill. There's also flood control mitigation money in here at about $30 million. $35 million for local roads and bridges, $25 million for the exterior renovation repair of the state capitol, $20 million for wastewater infrastructure, $6 million for reinvest in Minnesota, i.e. the RIM program. Madam Chair and members, there were about $2.6 billion worth of requests. Somehow capital bonding draws a crowd. And so a lot of requests. I'm not sure how many, but certainly easily several hundred from all over Minnesota, from all kinds of agencies of state government. And so there's a lot of demand on this money. The Capital Investment Committee worked, I think, as hard and arduously as we could in terms of putting together a bill which I think tried to reflect the basic needs of Minnesota. Obviously, there's many people perhaps in this audience and elsewhere out in television land right now that may be disappointed their project didn't make the list, but that is the way it is when you're trying to deal with a number that can work within this legislature from the standpoint of being large enough to on one side attract some votes and small enough on the other side to try to attract some votes. So you try to look for, Madam Chair, that sweet spot. At $496 million, this is about $281 million less than the governor's proposal. It's accordingly at $280 million in the House. It's obviously maybe about a little over $300 million ahead of the House. So it's one of those bills that's generally speaking in that middle of that that road, so to speak. And I think overall it has reflected, notwithstanding some disappointments yesterday in the bonding committee, I think it seems to have general support. We'll certainly see going forward. So, Madam Chair and members, if I could, I'd just like Ms. Plowman to take you generally through the bill, not in a very specific manner, but just categorically. And Mr. Jensen is here as well, and of course Stephanie James from Senate Counsel. If you have any questions, concerns, we can certainly try to address them. Take any amendments which you might have.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Could you remind us once more what was the bonding bill last year? It was very comparable to this, wasn't it?
Madam Chair and members, yes. The bonding bill leaving last year on GO bonds was 497. So it's funny how things work out. We're almost to that number.
And almost to a billion for the biennium then.
Yeah, just short, I think 490 or so. You can do the addition, but pretty close.
So, which is very close to what most people might expect in a biennium, I imagine.
Yeah, and that was another factor in kind of, you know, looking at the bill, trying to keep it within, you know, the consistency. I didn't add, Madam Chair, that the governor's bill is based on the forecast, which is 775, and so this bill is a couple of hundred million below that.
Ms. Plowman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, going through the bill here in subcategories, we have the University of Minnesota at 39.06, Minsku for 127.07, 028, Education for $1 million, Minnesota State Academies for $1 million, Purpich Center for Arts Education, $263. For DNR, we have $56 million, Pollution Control Agency, $5.256, Board of Soil and Water Resources, $12 million, Agriculture, $706. Rural Finance Authority, $33 million. Zoological Gardens, $7 million. Administration, we have $35.867. Amateur Sports Commission, $375. Military Affairs, $25. Public Safety, $4.037. Transportation, $43.5. Metropolitan Council, 12.85. Human Services, 2.5. Veterans Affairs, 29.816. Corrections, 12.391. Employment and Economic Development, we have 77.85. Public Facilities Authority Request, 24.85. And Housing Finance Agency, we have $30 million in housing finance bonds and $6 million in GO bonds. Minnesota Historical Society, 3.25, and the bond sale expenses is $560 for a total of $496.483 in GO bonds.
Thank you, Ms. Pullman. Are there questions about projects, or we can look into the language a little? Is there anything that we should especially note in the language of the bill? We actually look mainly at the numbers here, but Senator Senjum?
Madam Chair, thank you for reminding me of one point, which is hopefully something that we can have some conversation about in the conference committee. It has it. It's in page 36, and it's a little unique and a little different. The first one has to do with the subdivision 4 at the bottom. This is Senator Gerlach's thought. He's had this conversation, I think, with the committee at other times, not necessarily this committee, but the idea that, we're doing a bonding bill. We talk a lot about job creation. Let's try to identify for the record what the impact of a bonding bill is on jobs. And so that is included in there. And the other piece that we put in the bill on page 37, section 30, has to do with what we call business development through capital projects program. I'm sorry, I may have an older bill.
Right. The section you were referring to on the report on job creation is on page 37, section 29.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Nonetheless, the speech is the same. and this is a program, Madam Chair, that as we considered all of the local projects that come into the fray of a bonding bill, and there are many, and how do you make these kind of judgments? One of the things that we've had in place for a number of years, say, for instance, on the dam safety side and or the wastewater infrastructure side, is that the bonding committee actually makes allocations to, in the case of wastewater infrastructure, the PFA group, Public Facilities Authority, and on the dam safety side, to DNR, to make allocations to that fund. And in this case, Madam Chair, looking at the way this is constructed, it would go into a fund that's managed by deed, and that they would make value judgments on projects going forward based on some criteria that are listed in here, things like cost-benefit analysis and so on. We thought we wanted to have the conversation about that. I will tell you, Madam Chair, it's no secret, Senator Langs has been there, as you get more and more of these projects, and particularly local projects, and this would be for a local project menu. It is incredibly difficult to separate one from another and say this ought to go on the list and that one shouldn't. So conversationally, and we'll see where it goes, we wanted to have that that discussion in conference committee.
Are there any questions about those provisions?
That validation process yesterday.
If not, are there any amendments?
Madam Chair.
Madam Senator Chair. Perry.
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A8 amendment.
The A8 amendment will be distributed.
I'd like to, as well, Madam Chair, there update that amendment and with an oral amendment, if I can.
The amendment is distributed to most people. Do you have a copy? Do you want to start explaining it?
Yes, Madam Chair, this amendment is for the Mankato Civic Center, and working with folks, we found that, you know, I just believe that, we need to include the third great outstate city with a project, and what we've come up here with is we've been able to look through and find $250,000. For this project, and the amendment is a grant to the City of Mankato to design, construct, furnish, and equip the expansion of the Civic Center Auditorium, along with the Performing Arts Theater and remodeling the expansion of the Civic Center. However, orally, I'd like to amend this, if I may, on line 1.11, after the word center, we would put a comma, then we would delete and All Seasons Arena, which must include the Southern Minnesota Women's Hockey Exposition Center. So we would delete all of 1.12, 1.13, and through the word center on 1.14. Does that read okay, Mr. Bonner?
Mr. Bonner?
Madam Chair and Senator Perry, that's correct. And I don't know if you want to deal with the totals next.
Yes, correct. The other would be on line 1.15. We would put a period after Civic Center and delete and all, and then on 1.16, Season Arena. We would also scratch the $1 million and insert $250,000. We go up to line 1.13. Which reads page 30, line 11, delete $5 million and insert 4.5. It would be $4,775,000. And line 1.12, which reads page 30, line 6, says delete $5 million and insert. We would change that again to $4,775,000.
Discussion on the amendment. Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, does the change in the amendment, the oral changes that you just offered, still allow Mankato to do the plan and to accomplish the plans that they had set out? Because I was disappointed that the Mankato provision was not in the bonding bill, and so I thank you for offering the amendment, but I'm wondering if it's really enough so that they can actually accomplish what they're setting out to accomplish.
Senator Perry?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, we have had discussions, and this is a starting point, and I truly believe that this needs to be discussed even more so once it gets into the conference committee setting, and this is an avenue for that to happen.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langston.
I think the idea is to have a, I guess you'd call it a placeholder, so that all three could be discussed as the bill moves along. So the numbers don't mean that much. It's just that we wanted them Mankato included, so as the bill moves along, we could be discussing all three rather than just two.
Madam Chair,
Senator
just to
Bond.
Follow up then. Madam Chair, if you wouldn't mind, I see that Senator Sharon's actually sitting there. I just wondered if she would like to just say a comment at all about that.
Senator Sharon.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you for your patience on this, and especially to the chair. We've had this discussion yesterday, and there was interest among the members of the committee to try to find a way to continue to have this project be included and continued in the conversations. So members of the committee agreed to try to put a placeholder. And I have with me our city manager, Pat Henches, who can really speak specifically to any questions you might have about the details of the project. So I defer to him.
Two members. Briefly, please. I think it's been covered probably well in the bonding committee.
Madam Chair, before...
Senator Perry.
Maybe we can ask Mr. Henches, because I know Senator Bonhoff had the specific question of, you know, even with this amount, placeholder, whatever you want to call it, if that's enough to get started. So maybe if he could address that.
Mr. Henches.
Madam Chair, Senator Perry and Senator Bonhoff, I believe that this is a starting point, and I'm very grateful for the consideration by the committee to consider this as a placeholder, and hopefully as this bill moves to the floor and to the conference committee for discussions, perhaps we can have further details at this point. But I'm very grateful for the committee to consider this amendment.
Mr. Henches, is this mainly for an addition or rebuilding?
At this point in time, the project that we proposed with the larger amount, Madam Chair, included both a remodeling of the hockey-related facilities that Minnesota State University hockey program utilizes, and it includes some additions to our convention center that allow for year-round use and dedication of our arena to Minnesota State, which is now divided among a number of facilities that they practice out of.
Okay, thank you. Any additional questions for our witness? Okay, if not, we will take up Senator Perry's motion on the A8 amendment as amended. All in favor?
Madam Chair, can I just offer
Senator,
you know,
Senchum?
We've had discussions about this. I assured the people from Mankato yesterday that we would have these discussions irrespective of an item within the budget. But to give assurance that those discussions occur, I would support doing this going forward.
Thank you, Senator Senchum. So on the A8 amendment with the changes incorporated, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langset.
I have a technical amendment. I think Mr. Jensen's probably got the amendment written up, but it has to do with the Hormel Institute. And it was to go to, according to the way it's written, it's to go to the city of Austin. It needs to go to the Austin Port Authority. So just a technical change. And I guess you, Mr. Jensen, you probably have the page number and so on. Where it is.
Mr. Jensen.
Madam Chairman, members, it's on page 30, line 16, where it says, for a grant to the city of Austin. You'd strike the words city of and say for a grant to the Port Authority, or excuse me, for a grant to the Austin Port Authority. Madam Chair, they noticed this and asked to make that change.
Does everyone understand that amendment?
Yeah.
On 3016, cancel the word city of and after Austin put in Port Authority. On that motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, I have the A12 amendment. I don't know if it's in everybody's packet or not.
I think it has to be distributed.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump?
Just a curious question. Does
How did Austin end up with a Port Authority?
During a flood. The floods.
During a flood.
Madam Chair, when we're handing out the amendment, I could probably answer that. It is on the Cedar River, which starts in Hayfield, my hometown. And I've never seen too many ships on it.
Members, this is an amendment that we saw yesterday. We were going to put it on Senator Jungbauer's claims bill, but we need a little more information about it. And so we said we would find another home for it, and so we thought we'd attach it to this one. The bonding bill has flood relief in it as well, and this actually, Senator Ingebrigtsen, but this actually is the amendment that that would help take care of the remainder of expenses related to some past floods. This is for the FEMA matches. It's necessary to have that, and we are. And I think I'll let Mr. Gustafson explain where this money might be coming from.
Madam Chair, members, you'll recall we discussed yesterday the Clause A reduces the flood-related appropriation to the Commissioner of Agriculture from the fall 2010 special session by $285,000, a portion of that money being unspent, reduces that prior appropriation and reallocates it for the FEMA match necessary for the spring 2010 floods. This was a governor's supplemental budget recommendation, as well as a $50,000 appropriation to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for a grant to Mankato Water Resources Center. So that's where the redirection of prior special session appropriation.
So, members, we had previously given $4 million to the Department of Ag related to the 2010 floods. $2 million was canceled back last year. There's still $2 million approximately available. And so we are taking a small portion of that and using it, again, for flood-related purposes. So that is what's happening here. And I don't know, Senator Senjum, if you want to explain anything about Section C here, the $50,000. I think you know something about that.
Madam Chair and members, for those that might have been here in the 2010 special session, and this relates to a southern Minnesota flood that we incurred a special session to address. One of the things as we addressed a bonding bill to cover those damages was the whole issue about what are we going to do about these floods? We just keep, you know, paying money as, you know, to cover the cost of the damage that occurred. And so there was discussion at that point that we ought to do some upstream analysis, and this Zumbro Valley watershed goes nearly to Austin. It comes up around the east side of Owatonna, going up to Wanamingo, which your committee chair is well aware of, and so on and so forth. It's a huge, huge area. But this money here, as events have now unfolded and as recovery has occurred and people have talked about, well, what are we going to do about any future flood prevention methods for this great big watershed? The thought was, and we've worked a little bit with this Mankato Water Resources Center, which is out of Minnesota State University. They have some flood control analysis tools which are almost amazing when you see them in terms of predictability and GIS and all of that, that we might take some amount of money and really do an analysis. What might be the best way to, again, try to mitigate future floods? Is it are they storage? Is it farming practices? Is it in fact berms through cities or whatever it might be? But give us some idea as to whether or not flood mitigation practices could be employed to prevent what happened. And everything almost east of Owatonna, including Owatonna, from happening again. That's a difficult task, but this would help us, I think, uncover some semblance of information that might address possible future mitigation.
Senator Magnus?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out to the committee members and the audience that you and I met with the Ag Commissioner yesterday and talked extensively about this
about this proposal that Senator Ingebretson has presented, and we support that effort. That certainly was the intent of the legislation when we did it. I think is trying to help this floods thing. So we're supportive of the amendment.
Are there any other questions about the A-12 amendment? If not, all in favor of the A-12 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a technical amendment. If it's all right with you, I would just do a verbal or an oral amendment on page 15. Line 15.15, we would strike after the word two, we would strike all of that language, Renville County to construct a waste transfer facility. That should read, after the word two, should read Redwood, Renville Counties, Joint Regional Material Recovery. Let me start over again. Redwood, Renville Counties to construct a Joint Regional Materials Recovery Facility.
I think your line reference wasn't right. I think it's 15.12.
15.15.
I don't know.
You said it was 15.15.
Mr. Bodden, did you catch that? Or Mr. Gustafson?
Madam Chair and members, I think Senator Magnus may have used a slightly incorrect page and line reference. I think we're dealing with page 15, line 13.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think, if I heard it correctly, I just want to restate it so we make sure we have it right. It should be delete Renville County. Delete everything after 2 and insert on page 15, line 13, and insert Redwood and Renville Counties to construct a joint regional materials recovery. And then I'm not sure, are we retaining waste transfer facility? Yeah.
Just facility?
No,
just facility.
And on page 15, line 14, delete waste transfer.
Okay, does everyone have that? All in favor of Senator Magnus's motion to amend? On lines 15, 13, and 15, 14, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Is there anything else?
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
I have the A6.
The A6 amendment will be distributed.
Madam Chair, while they're passing out, I can just begin.
Senator Rana.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, I'm putting before you an amendment to include the Southwest Light Rail project. And as members are aware, the governor put $25 million in for this project. This project is the Twin West Chamber of Commerce number one priority. Just in fact, yesterday, members from the Twin West Chamber, from the Minneapolis Chamber, the chair from the Met Council, myself, met with the governor to talk about this project and its potential impact on this region. For those who aren't aware, this project would this line would start at the Twin Stadium, and it would go through St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Minnetonka, and end in Eden Prairie at the Opus Center, where the headquarters of United Health Group is. This project, by putting forward the $25 million for the beginning phase, we're really leveraging $625 million of federal dollars. In this particular one, the Southwest Light Rail Project was only one of 10 federal New Starts projects selected to move into preliminary engineering amongst 100 applicants and the only project to be selected in the Midwest. Every $1 invested by the state returns an additional $9 investment from the project's partners. I would say it is safe to say that no other project in the bonding bill comes close to that return on investment. There was a public opinion poll that was done by a bipartisan group of marketing folks, and their key findings include just going to statewide people, not even just in this area, 76% of Minnesotans said that we would benefit from expanded and improved public transportation. Statewide, people were asked, would they like to use public transportation more? 69% said they would. There was 61% support statewide for the Southwest Light Rail. I think it's disappointing that it was not seriously considered in the House or Senate transportation bill. The state's share is much less than any of the other partners with regard to this project. Each city along this corridor has introduced and passed a resolution offering strong support for this. So I guess, you know, I do offer the amendment, but I would also ask Senator Senjum. And by the way, Senator Senjum, I remember when you spoke on a panel with myself and the other legislative leaders with the Twin West Chamber, and everybody implored the leaders at that time, both yourself and Speaker Zellers, to strongly consider putting this in that in your bonding bill this year. So I wondered if you could just share some of the conversation and the thinking behind not having this in the bill. And by the way, we would stand to lose the federal money that they have put forward.
Madam Chair and members, this is a major policy initiative. Again, expanding light rail into the suburbs, going into downtown core area of Minneapolis. As we looked at it, and I frankly asked for advice and counsel from Senator Gimsey on that and the Transportation Committee, you may or may not have seen a letter which they prepared and sent to the governor indicating that, in their opinion at least, and frankly backed up by some statutory language, that we should not move forward basically in some part at least by virtue of the fact that there was no guaranteed federal funds that would ever suggest we could complete this project. And so with respect to it, I'm not going to get that far ahead in a bonding bill in terms of transportation policy. It was not included. If and when the time would ever occur when the Transportation Committee would warm up to ideas like this, I think the bonding committee would certainly work in collaboration with them. But right now, I don't think that committee is ready to move on the expansion of light rail in the Twin City area.
Senator Bonna?
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, I think you have hit the nail on the head that we have a Transportation Committee chair who needs to, quote, warm up to the idea of light rail as a viable alternative. And I think that's too bad. You know, I spoke to a group of students from St. John's and St. Ben's a couple days ago, and my son is a junior there, so I was happy to speak to them. And I shared with them how strongly I supported this project. And then I said, how many of you would like to have this, you know, a light rail option for you in the Twin Cities such as this? Everybody raised their hand. I think that we underestimate the importance of having a comprehensive a mass transit system as we look at both keeping the elderly population able to get around and not be dependent on people and stuck in their homes, as well as attracting young adults to our region, keeping our children wanting to live in the Twin Cities because it's a modern city, you know, competing with Chicago, Los Angeles, you know, the other major metropolitan areas. I think it is too bad that our chair of transportation is not, quote, warm to the idea of light rail, and I don't think that's representative of what a chair of transportation ought to how they ought to view it.
Madam Chair, can I just say, and if I suggested I was going to throw all this responsibility on his shoulder, I was wrong. I think there's a prevailing view around here that we ought not get too far ahead out on this. As I recall, the budget, when completed on this, is $1 billion to $1.5 billion. We don't know if that money will ever come. And so until we get some better thoughts or some better ideas about whether that money would ever arrive, I think that's in large part the hesitancy perhaps shared by not only the chair but other members of the Transportation Committee and, frankly, other members of the legislature. So, again, it was not the desire of the bonding committee to get way out in front in terms of policy initiatives that relate to transportation that there was hesitancy not only on part of the Transportation Committee, frankly, the House and the Senate, but also a large number of other legislators.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonhoff, a week or so ago, my son and I were just looking on the internet, and we brought up the website on the Southwest Corridor, and it looked to me like the Met Council is already appropriated, I don't know, $25 million or $27 million, something in that neighborhood, and is doing something very similar to what you are suggesting be done in this bill, preliminary work on it. Am I incorrect on that? Is the Met Council not already engaged in some of this preliminary work and is put up a considerable sum of money for that purpose?
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, they're not here right now, so I can't speak for the Met Council. I have the numbers of how much the CTIB board is committed. They're planning to pay 30% of the cost. The Hennepin County Railroad Authority will pay 10%, and then the state's share would be 10%. And with regard to the feds have put this in their New START project conditional on getting state funding. If the state does not come through with their 10% share, we will lose our place in line and very well could lose the opportunity for the project entirely. With regard to what the Met Council has already done or not done, I, over the past, maybe at least 3 years, have attended community meetings at various points along the corridor where there has been a tremendous amount of study that's been done, identifying which route this will go. Took, I think, at least 2 years of the communities to have public testimony, to come together. Hundreds of citizens along this corridor have weighed in, and the locals have made commitments. Whether or not Met Council has committed this number, I don't know, and I can't speak for them.
Thank you.
Senator Olson was next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonhoff, I'm not sure if you're the one to clarify this, but I did get that letter and read it, and I was, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. Which comes first? Does the state have to commit first, or does the federal have to commit first? I can understand if they've got the biggest pot and you're uncertain about it, that makes you a little reluctant to put out the money ahead of it. And so even though it was selected and this was a good idea at the federal level, maybe there's some of us that get a little mistrust of what the federal government does or does not do and when. And that is, I think, a difficulty. Is there any guarantee that came with that approval that they, in fact, would deliver the money, and at what point?
Madam
Senator
Chair, I saw Scott Peterson from MnDOT here. I don't know if he's still here. I don't know if he could come to the table. It is my understanding that the New Starts program, which this was approved, I think there is some concern that it may not last many years going forward, but as I understand it, it was approved for this if they actually did commit, if the state would do that. But I don't want to be on record for exactly how that process works. I'm disappointed there isn't somebody coming to the table on that.
Yes, Senator Bonhoff, I think there is always concern as the federal government is starting to make budget cuts as well,
right,
that we make a big commitment and then they don't bring their dollars forward. That the Senator Olson said it's kind of a chicken and egg issue, or
which
comes first. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I was going to give the same breakout in percentages that Senator Bonoff said. But, you know, it is one of those things where you need to commit so you can commit, and you need to commit so you can commit. And so it is just kind of a big puzzle. But the competition at the federal level is so fierce for these funds that if we don't commit, we'll be years behind. And as Senator Bonoff said, it just takes such a long time to get these projects going. You know, if we only have a train that goes from here to here, we don't have a light rail system. We have a line. And if you don't live somewhere between here and here, it's not really most useful. What we need is a whole system so people can get from here to there and multiple places on the light rail system. And I think it's just absolutely critical that we get this funding in this bill.
Senator Bonoff?
Madam Chair, I'm going to follow up with the Met Council and get answers to both Senator Newman's question and Senator Olson. So I think what I'd like to do is withdraw the amendment for, I don't know. I see some people have come in the room. I don't know if they wanted to speak on the line or not. But I was planning to withdraw the amendment, get that information, and be prepared on the floor for that information.
Okay, Senator Bonoff withdraws the A6 amendment. Are there further amendments? Senator Sinjum, do you have any additional amendments?
Madam Chair, not to my recollection.
Yes.
All right.
I think there is a technical one.
I am going
one.
To recollect. All right. Madam Chair, I'm told it's the A4 amendment.
The A4 amendment.
Madam Chair, and also an A3 amendment.
On the A4 amendment. Senator Perry, do you want to move the A4 so we can have a discussion on it, please?
A4? I'll move the A4 amendment.
Madam Chair and members, I'm told this is a drafting error, and sounds like Mr. Jensen can help out with an explanation.
Mr. Jensen?
Madam Chair, we had the Minnesota River crossing in the bill twice, so this amendment just takes it out once and still leaves it in the bill. It was a drafting error.
The language is stated twice?
Yes, Madam Chair.
That's section 4?
It's on page 23, line 10. It's also on page 23, line 34. And this corrects the drafting paragraphs here.
I see. It is just repeated twice in here. But there's quite a bit more on here, if I'm looking at the right one.
Madam Chair, on the amendment, line 1.4, we're just repeating this and again correcting, adding the word and just correcting the language, line 1.2. It's kind of a style the way the reviser wants this language.
I'm sorry, which line were you referring to, Mr. Jensen?
Well, the additional language is on like 1.2 through 1.11. That's repeating what's in page 23, line 23.2 to 23.9.
Right.
Just the style kind of additional.
Okay, I understand that. But then there's also, in this amendment, there's an, I don't know if this is new, something for Norwood Young America and Stuartville. That's Stephanie, Ms. James.
Madam Chair and members, this amendment, yesterday when the Capital Investment Committee met, we were working off of a Senate Council-generated document, and then in the time between that and introduction, the reviser's office completed the bill, which was introduced. This amendment, and then there were some discrepancies between the way the bill was introduced and the document that the committee had considered. So this amendment fixes those things so that the bill matches the document considered by the Capital Investment Committee. While it looks more involved, it looks like things are added, it really is, we've deleted them and then re-added them as a result of formatting issues in getting the bill into the proper form.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
If the committee is comfortable, I would move that amendment. Unless somebody else
Senator
has
Perry had moved okay. It already. So this is all pretty much technical. All of these provisions are in. One is in too often, and we're removing it.
Yes.
Okay. On Senator Perry's motion on the A4 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And then we have the A3 amendment has already been distributed.
Madam President, the A3 amendment pertains to this grant program I described earlier that we want to talk about in conference committee going forward, that we might adjudge local projects through this program and make decisions at the deed level rather than, and those recommendations would come to the full body. This is a wording amendment, frankly, and Senator Perry, this precludes the need of the bonding bill to come to your committee, but otherwise accomplishes the task.
Does everyone understand the A3 amendment?
I would move the A3 amendment.
Senator Perry would like to save a little work for his committee.
First the A3.
If not, all in favor of the A3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. 13. We also have the A16 amendment, which will be distributed.
Madam Chair.
Should have moved it to
your committee. Is this the part we took out? Or is this the part? Couldn't we just do this right? Senator
Chair, I would offer
Senator
the
Magnus?
16 amendment.
Okay, on the A16 amendment, and I can help explain this. This is a clarifying amendment on page 23, line 34 and 35. There's some words that have to be inserted into the language to make it comfortable with bond counsel. Are there any questions about the A16 amendment? If not, all in favor of the A16, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment does prevail, and it is adopted. Are there any other amendments? Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, I don't have an amendment, but I just want to go back for just a moment on the grant program. I'm just wondering, this is just a thought. The bonding process is one that has, we juggle year after year trying to figure out what should be in the bonding bill and what shouldn't be in the bonding bill. And I know as Senator Senjum, as the chair, you're in an extremely difficult position trying to take care of a lot of the important concerns across the state. But at the same time, there is a need to garner enough votes to get this big battleship floating. And I'd hate to see the bonding process sanitized to the extent that some local needs don't get addressed. And I think that I had a feeling of that this year when a project came up in the Minsky system, when we were questioning the chancellor and some of the people about how do they react to new programs or how do they address new programs. They have this system, and I support it, you know, where they have this numbering system down the line, and if you don't get into that system, you basically, you know, you have to wait or either don't get your project funded. There still has to be kind of a release valve where when something happens or if there's a need that has to be addressed, that you can address that. And I think that as you get into the conference setting, I think that needs to be kept in mind.
Senator Senjum.
And Madam Chair and members, Senator Stump, I couldn't agree more. This is at certainly the idea stage at this point. We hope that we can talk about this more at conference committee. Hope that every member maybe looks at it between now and as we go to the floor. Hope it stays in, because I think it does have warrant at least some discussion, some strong consideration. But you know, if there's a different way to do this, may or may not be better, but hopefully we can give that have a conversation to get to that point, and even coming back, if it's not something that's agreeable, why, you know, there'll be amendments on the final bill as well, I'm sure.
So are there any other comments on Senate File 2577? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, along that line, I know that historically there's been an effort to keep some balance between the metro area and greater Minnesota, particularly in the area of the parks and trails and the regional parks. And I don't know whether I was a little bit late, so I don't know if that was addressed at all or if anybody has raised that issue. But it is... there's only $1 million that is given to the Metropolitan Regional Parks capital improvements, and there's $5 million to DNR for such improvements, as in addition to the $5 million for Vermilion State Park. And I'm not saying I disagree with those, but I think it is definitely a departure from what has been the case before, because our regional parks serve a tremendously large population, larger than 50%, and the parks are and trails are heavily used. The new one that has been going through my district, the Hennepin County part of it, I think Carver County has finished their part, and McLeod County will be adding to it the Dakota Rail Trail. They expected about 75,000 people the first year, and they got 250,000. It's been a very popular trail, and I'm not suggesting that particular one needs the revenue at this point, but I do think that there is it's important to keep the equity and not between these regions, between the greater Minnesota and the metro region in terms of that park support and investment. And so I hope that that something can be done. I haven't got an amendment to that effect, but I want to raise the issue because I think it is an important one to keep that balance.
Senator Sinch.
Thank you. I'm not sure we specifically analyze that, as at least we consider the bill. We've analyzed a couple of other factors here, but and it does that analysis becomes a little more difficult with the legacy money and so on, and how you make all that work and in a balanced fashion. I know that's been a point of conversation around here for a couple of years, but we'll certainly take consideration of that and as we go forward
that.
and respect your comments, Senator Olson.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I hadn't realized that we were putting $5 million into Lake Vermilion State Park in this bill. Can you tell? I can't tell from the language in here what exactly it is we're going to do with it.
Senator Sinch. Okay.
It's on page 14. It just says, for the development of Lake Vermilion State Park established under Minnesota statute, blah, blah.
I can tell you conceptually, we were up there, looked at it. It's obviously new. There's a short, small bit of development that's occurred already on the park. I wish Senator Bach was here, but this really reflects some additional development relative to, obviously, public amenities on and within that park. And I can't be more specific than that based on what's in the bill. Maybe my help can help me.
Madam Chairman, one of the big needs there is some roads so there would be access to all that acreage. And there would be cabins and showers, et cetera. But there's really no access to the park for the public right now, and this would help do that.
And Madam Chair and
Senator
Mr.
Higgins.
Jensen, how this will bring us up to how much that we have spent on Lake Vermilion State Park yet so far?
Mr. Jensen?
Madam Chair, in the special session last July, there was $8 million. So also there was some transfer of money because of the fire in the Tower Sudan State Park underground, about $1.2 million, I think.
Went to that.
So that's part of that park now.
I'm looking forward to getting to this state park someday.
Senator Higgins. So besides the acquisition price with this $5 million, we would have about $13 million invested in development?
Commissioner.
Yes, Madam Chair. Plus the purchase price.
Did we ever hear about what the expectations for full development are? I mean, we probably heard this when we were purchasing the land. It was several years ago, and I don't recall, but I don't know if we had a full estimate. Have we any indication what that might be?
Madam Chair, I don't have a good number to answer your question.
I don't know. I can't see behind me, but if there's somebody from DNR that could probably be more helpful than any one of us on that question.
Madam Chair, Kent Lacus-Moe from DNR. The appropriation this year for $5 million would really go towards developing a lakeside campground, so there's ability for people to use the park. And I think your other question was, what's the total projected cost for full development of the park? And that's in the area of about $30 million.
Which is significantly more than the purchase price, isn't it?
Madam Chair, yes.
Was the purchase about $13 million? Or how much was it?
Madam Chair, I believe it was about $16 million. There was $20 million appropriated, and then the other $4 million went towards development. And as Mr. Jensen said, the first work was to develop roads and utilities.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
So I thought that we had been told that it was 8 and then now this is 5, but you say we've already got 20 into it?
Mm-hmm. We
plus
bought
this
the land.
Last year's 8 and now this 5?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, the 20 was the purchase of the property and the land. I mean, that was what was first appropriated, and I believe that purchase price was about $16 million. So the remaining four went for development. And then last year there was $8 million appropriated for development, and this bill provides an additional five.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langseth.
I remember when we were discussing whether or not we should do this or not, and I was a little skeptical because we were spread so thin on state parks the way it is. But, you know, we talk about metro versus rural. Most of the people that put the most pressure on me to do it were from metro. So many of these very popular state parks are frequented to a large extent by metro people. I think Itasca State Park is one example and so on. But it was sort of decided that if we are going to do this, it should be developed. I think the people up in that area had a difference of opinion as to whether that land should be sold off and developed for individuals on the lake or it should be a state park. And when it was kind of decided, and Governor Plenty was very strongly supporting the park, and there was sort of an agreement that if we do it, we have to develop it. And that's where we're at with this now, I think.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just kind of curious, being it sounds like we're going to, at the end of the whole project, going to be about $50, $55 million. Was there ever a plan associated with how we're going to recoup that money and how long it would take to pay it back through the fees that would be charged through the development? I mean, I think every time I see money being going out, I never see if there's going to be some kind of return. Senator Bonoff, with your light rail, nobody talks about what it's going to cost to maintain, what it's going to cost, you know, is there a sustainability to it, what we're going to subsidize it. And, you know, I think the citizens deserve to know that in this case, if this investment continues and we build this, is there a return on that investment, and will there be a time period through the rental of these sites to pay the citizens back for what we've contributed?
Mr. Lacasmo, did you have a master plan when the land was initially purchased, or was that developed after?
Madam Chair, there is a master plan. When exactly that was developed through the process and when it was completed, I'm not positive of. But there is a master plan. I mean, this certainly is property that's worthy of protection. It's a very unique piece of property on Lake Vermilion. And it is projected to be a very popular state park. It should rival Lake Itasca, I expect, and it may be one of the few state parks that is economically can support itself. And I can provide those, you know, the specifics to the committee if they desire. I don't have those available with me today.
When you say it could economically support itself, you mean in operating costs once it's up and running, but not to reimburse for all of the investment that's been put into it.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And, you know, it's the same with the light rail. We probably only get about a third of the fares to pay for operating costs. It's probably the fares only cover a third of operating costs, and I think that's been the tradition in the metro area in the past. In some areas, it's quite a bit less than that even. Senator Bonner?
Madam Chair, I can't let Senator Perry make those comments and not address them. So with regard to the Southwest Light Rail line, I'm going to get the numbers here. In terms of the original investment dollars, our ability to leverage our dollars, it's a return on investment of 9-1, and there's a projection of 3,800 jobs, and that doesn't even count the amount of jobs that those folks like United Health Group have expanded in that area and expect that actually to happen, that Southwest Light Rail line. And with regard to subsidies, we have created a formula that has been working now for the other lines in terms of local match versus state. And I think to say that we're subsidizing a light rail line when we don't say the same thing with roads, because that's what our gas tax goes for. We're all subsidizing our roads. And so it's a user fee. And, no, I don't think that's accurate, those comments that you made.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator, Senjum, the discrepancy between the DNR fund and the Metro Parks fund is, you know, huge. It's $10 million for DNR parks and $1 million for the 42 Metro Parks. So as you're going along, I'd really appreciate it. Like Senator Olson said, is that that's a real problematic part of the bill, and we'd appreciate your support in trying to get the Metro Parks a more equitable number.
Message delivered.
Hear, hear.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langseth.
If there is no more questions, I would move the bill. And I would just like to mention I was chair for 10 years, so I know what it's like to try to put a bill together and what you say yes to and what you say no to. I think many of us thought the bill should have been larger, being that this was a regular bonding bill, bonding year. But given the size of the bill, there's a lot of good things in here. It's basically a pretty good bill. There are some holes that it would be kind of nice to fill along the way, but I do move the bill, and I will support it.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I understand there may be one more amendment. A-13, is that correct?
Senator Langseth, we had to delay your motion on passage. Can you move the amendment, please? Senator Langseth moves the A-13 amendment. Quick explanations, Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair and members, this, again, goes back to this idea of a local projects bonding fund. Okay, I'm standing corrected. I'm going to let Senate Counsel if...
Ms. James?
I'm sorry, it's under Transportation Development Grants.
Madam Chair, members, yes, this adds some activities that are allowable for the Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Program grants. It adds pre-design, design, and acquisition of lands to things like construction and reconstruction that are allowed.
Any questions on that? If not, all in favor of the A-13 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Are there any other amendments? Any other discussion? If not, Senator Langseth moves that Senate File 2577, as amended, be recommended to pass and be placed on general orders. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I know Senator Rosen. Oh, she is here.
I would guarantee
she has been waiting for a while, so we'll take her bill up next.
Yeah. I hope I didn't cut you off.
No. I bet we'll be back tonight. I bet you're right. I figured that. Oh, this is a bad one.
Any of them.
Good morning, Senator Rosen.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members.
If you would like to start with an explanation of your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would. Senate File 1808 is the Omnibus Retirement Bill. And just to tee things up, Madam Chair, members, the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement met very frequently this last fall and this during the session here a lot. It was very good to meet in this pension commission. And some of our goals were to look at the retirement plans, and we had good discussions on defined contribution, defined benefit, got a thorough hearing on the hybrid plan. But what we ended up doing is the Senate File 1808, and what we did in that is we adjusted the assumed rate of return. And I do have an amendment, Madam Chair, but if I could just briefly go through the bill again and get back to the amendment, that would be
fine.
Okay. And I'll get back to that rate of return. We also, in the bill, the MMB's contribution adequacy report is supposed to be in odd years on budgeted and forecasted defined benefit retirement plan appropriation state aid payments and contributions to meet the funding requirements. There's also in the bill a study for PRA to look at the eligibility to increase the salary threshold. We also have a state auditor working group recommendation for, number one, investment authority, and number two, the Volunteer Fire Relief Association. Also in the bill is the consolidation into PRA Police and Fire of the Fairmont Police Relief Association. It's one of the last of the police funds to be consolidated. And, Madam Chair and members, if there's any liability, it is the city's responsibility, and it's assumed off an 8% assumed rate of return. We also, in the bill, have the merger of the Virginia Fire Consolidation Account into the PRA Police and Fire. There is a volunteer fire retirement contributions portion, too, where the municipalities and nonprofit firefighting corporations make additional contributions, and PRA, the statewide volunteer firefighter retirement plan to pre-fund the future employer retirement coverage cost is in that section. There is a section on the Duluth Port Authority employees defined benefit coverage, where the service credit can be purchased with the money from the employee's account balance under, number one, the authority's current defined contribution plan or their deferred compensation balance. And any supplemental funding provided by the Port Authority, they can put money into the employee's account or any personal payment made by the employee. There's also a provision in here for the Minsky TRA retroactive coverage for an individual to coverage back to 2005 because of a failure to notify from Minsky. And two more, there's the Crookston employer PRA payment issue. For Crookston a Township and the Deputy Dewey's disability benefit. And before we start, Madam Chair, if we could have the amendment passed out, and that is the 4A amendment, and it is in your packet.
Should be in your folder, members, the A4.
And, Madam Chair, there's also a little summary here. If we could have that passed out, I'm not sure if that's been passed out yet. But it talks about what the amendment does and how the bill currently stands and what it will do to the adjusted contribution deficiency.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I'm the last person to know much about any of this stuff. So I'll just start there. But I see in the new language that starts on line 26 that in a couple of places, except for the legislator's retirement plan and the elective state officer's retirement plan, and then it goes on. And then up above, I see that we're at zero and zero. So can you explain that? And I actually don't know what any of this means, so you might have to really small words.
Senator Rosen.
Okay. If I could explain the amendment, and then Senator Higgins, because I might have Mr. Martin explain to your question.
Madam Chair, I'll move the amendment.
Senator Magnus moves the amendment. Senator, would you like to explain? Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. This is the amendment that was the final agreement from the Pension Commission. That was voted out of the Pension Commission. So in state government last Friday, it was amended to a proposal that we had a vote in the Pension Commission that failed 2-7 on. And basically, the way the bill stands right now, there's a higher deficiency level going into it. What was voted on out of Pension Commission, as if you look at this handout that I have where it has the three funds, 8% for 5 years and 8.5% thereafter, the deficiency is 1.64. If we stay with what the bill is right now, it's at 3.48. Current law is at 0.88% for TRA, and you can see what it does for MSRS and PRA. So this was an agreement to take it down to 8% for 5 years to study it if we need to, and Larry Martin can explain this a little bit better, but the study would also, if we want to keep it at 8%, we can, or it can go automatically back up to 8.5%. But it gives the Pension Commission the ability to continue looking at this. It was an agreement with the Pension Commission. I'll be honest, there was people on there that did not want to drop it down to 8.5%. But this was the agreed-upon language from all the funds to drop it down to 8%. So I'm taking this bill back to the original agreement coming out of the Pension Commission.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, I very much appreciate you taking it back to that. I heard particularly from my school districts that were quite concerned, and I just wanted to share something about the approach the Pension Committee has taken. I was at a conference that actually Jeb Bush was doing 2 years ago in Washington, D.C. It was on school reform, and in that conference, and there was, gosh, at least, 1,500 people at this conference, they had a speaker who was an expert at pensions. And the speaker was talking about how important it was nationally to get our arms around unfunded pensions and the approach to take. That speaker put up the legislation that we in Minnesota passed 2 years ago, I believe. That was for everybody to see. And he wasn't from Minnesota. He was just a national expert. And he talked about the steps that we had taken to preserve the long-term viability of our pension system, upping what the employers did, upping what the employees did, and he talked about how courageous it was, how bipartisan it was.
And the big thing was freezing.
Yeah, and freezing, right. And exactly. Right. So I just want to thank those who have served on that pension committee. Thank you for keeping the integrity of what you did create at that time and allowing that to work over time. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Senator Boff. I really appreciate that because everybody in this room, the funds and all the representatives and all the people that were part of that 2010, it was a monumental reform piece and very well respected nationwide. And they put their necks out. It is working. We saw a 23% return on some of the funds going forward. So this was part of that. I mean, this amendment is agreed upon in this pension bill going forward. I think that's something that needs to be respected. And and if you'd like to listen to hear from the funds, too, just to verify their support on this 4A amendment, that'd be fine. But it is extremely important that we get it back to the original agreement.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I share with Senator Higgins not a very extensive comprehension of this stuff, but the post-retirement interest rate assumption being lower, is that because do they put funds into a more conservative investment in order to assure the availability, or what can you kind of describe that for me?
Madam Chair,
Senator Rosen,
I would like to defer to Mr. Martin, he can explain better the amendment and the line 26.
And the importance of being at the 8.5 rather than the 8.0?
Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, in our actuarial assumptions, we do not have an explicit actuarial assumption for post-retirement increases. How that has been handled historically is a reduction in the interest rate assumption to account for what otherwise would be an explicit post-retirement adjustment mechanism actuarial assumption. So when the post-retirement mechanism works, when these plans are sufficiently well-funded again, it would be a 2.5% annual increase that's provided. So that the actuarial assumption here is a differential between the pre-retirement interest rate assumption and the post-retirement interest rate assumption of that 2.5%. Okay. So it's an implicit assumption rather than an explicit post-retirement adjustment assumption. The reason why the elected state officers, the constitutional officers plan, and the legislators plan are carried at zero, those are plans that are either totally pay-as-you-go or virtually pay-as-you-go. Mm-hmm. The elective state officers plan has always been a pay-as-you-go plan since it was created in 1967. Legislators plan once was terminally funded. That means that at retirement, the full actuarial reserves needed to pay a legislator's benefits over their retirement period were then appropriated. That was changed during one of the earlier budget difficulties, and the plan was made pay-as-you-go for all post-2004 retirees. So these two plans have no assets, and it's the recommendation of the actuary who values these two plans to no longer discount their future liabilities by an assumed rate of interest to be earned, since there are no assets on which to earn. Interest.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Martin, is that you said the post-2004 retirees, is that when we became elected officials before 2004 or when those who retire after 2004?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's those legislators who retire after 2003 or 2004. It was during that period that the plan was shifted from a terminal funding plan to a pay-as-you-go, simply to reduce the amount of that appropriation. As a consequence, there are a few assets for legislators who did retire before 2003 or 2004 that are earning interest, but it's a modest amount of money and is declining rapidly. Legislators, you might recall, after 1997, elected after 1997, are not covered by the legislators. A retirement plan. They're in a defined contribution plan. So this plan only applies to less than 40 current legislators at the moment, and that number will be declining presumably over time as legislators in that group complete their careers.
Thank you.
You explained it.
Are there any other questions about the 4A amendment? Senator Magnus, did you have a question about the amendment?
What's geometric average dollar?
I'm thinking I understand what's happening here, but how did you choose 5 years, that it would be affected for 5 years?
Madam Chair, this was the original bill came in at 10 years. So it would have... lowers the 8.5, which is one of the highest in the nation. There's about 7 or 9 plans at that high. The assumption to 8%, and we originally had it 10 years. It was a compromise, and that's what we do in commission. That's what the funds were more comfortable with, was 5 years, and then returns to the ultimate rate of 8.5% beginning July 2017. But with that is this 5-year select period of a study. So that would require the Pension Commission to deal with these long-term investment assumption rates and continue to look at this. But it gives us some breathing room to move forward and to feel comfortable if the economy continues to turn around that we can stay at 8%. Because if you do look back on the sheet that I pointed out, and the deficiencies definitely goes up with 8%. But with this bill, it goes up less than what with this amendment, it goes up less than what the bill stands right now. And it's important to keep the funds somewhat healthy.
Mr. Martin, could you review for us quickly what has been the past year's return, what has been the 10-year return, what has been the 20-year return? Do you have those figures?
Madam Chair, I can give you a generalized sense of them from the testimony that we got from the State Board. And if you want more detail, we do have the pension fund. Our directors here, they serve on the Investment Advisory Council of the State Board of Investment and would be more conversant with them. over the last couple, 3 years, the interest, the investment performance of these plans has been in the teens. We have had, as would be expected after the 2008 recession, when you come into a recovery, there are fairly reasonable or fairly decent rates of return. The 2007-2009 recession dropped values anywhere from 25% to 40%. Last 10-year rate of return, as I understand it, was in the neighborhood of 5.9, and if you go back 20 or 25 years, it's been over 8.5%.
Senator Langseth?
I had understood that every 30-year period or so, it has exceeded the 8.5%. I think that's correct.
Madam Chair, Senator, for a period of in the neighborhood of 30 years, which is about as long as we've kept good investment return numbers, it has been over 8.5%. It's, I think, 8.9% is my understanding of the testimony.
Have, Mr. Martin, have other states reduced their rates because their return, their long-term returns have been lower, or did they react to the short-term returns?
Madam Chair, there isn't a good clearinghouse of information that goes to the intent of why states do what they do. Minnesota has had an 8.5% investment rate of return since 1989. We have been one of the higher interest rate assumption states in the country, so a number of states never were at 8.5%. A number of states have reduced or considered reducing their interest rate assumptions, presumably because of a changed horizon as to investment performance possibilities. But I can't give you a comprehensive list or give you any accurate notion about why states have done what they've done.
And Senator Rosen, this amendment includes a study that will be done, and I assume come back with recommendations to us as to what this rate would be best set at for the long haul?
Yes, Madam Chair, yes, thank you. There will be a thorough actuarial analysis, and we'll continue to look at this. But this is a compromise. And I should say that the Pension Coalition for Retired Employees is they like the amendment. They did not want to change it at all, to drop it down to 8%, but they would like to have the original bill back. I believe I'm speaking that correctly. Perhaps we should get that correct. Sorry, Julie. That's
okay. Good morning.
Morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5, and I'm here representing the Public Employees Pension Coalition, which is made up of all the public employee unions active and also the public employee retiree unions or retiree organizations. Our position has been that we did not want pension legislation to move forward this session. We supported the 2010 reforms. But I want to make clear that removing the language that was put on in the last committee and moving it back to what the Pension Commission has set forth and what Senator Rosen is attempting to do here is something that we would want to happen. So.
Okay. Anyone else want to comment on this? I know there's been a lot of discussion about it. And so
Madam Chair, I know you've
had a lot in the Pension Commission and state government, and I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood what we were doing. Mm-hmm. So if there's no other discussion on the 4A amendment, please signify by on the motion to approve the A4 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment does prevail, and it is adopted. And Senator Rosen, do you want to continue? Somebody had a question. Oh, you've gotten your answer, Senator Higgins, from Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure if you want a little more thorough discussion on the bill from Mr. Martin, or if you'd like to have Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Vanek, or Ms. Hacking from the funds come up and testify. I kind of gave a brief summary of what is in the bill. The main part was that the assumed rate of return bringing that back to what was the agreed-upon language in the Pension Commission. There are some other important pieces, but not quite as important, except for the Fairmont lease.
I did notice that we are bringing in Fairmont and Virginia. They're police. Two, one is police and one is a fire. And I know we've brought others into the PERA account in the past. And I'm just wondering, what conditions do they come in under? Do they have deficient funds now, and then we're rolling them in? And are they making an additional contribution, or are we making an additional contribution? I see we're not really spending any money on this bill. So I'm just wondering how that is working.
Madam Chair, if we could have Ms. Vanek speak to that, I think it would be appropriate. I know the Fairmont is very similar to what we did last year with the Minneapolis. They will assume any deficiencies going forward, Fairmont will, and it will be assumed at the 8%. But certainly Ms. Vanek can speak to this.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. Yes, the way we structure any merger or consolidation with PERA is that the cost, the remaining unfunded liability has to be borne by the community that's merging its group. For example, Virginia Fire came in under our administration last year as a separate account. They now want to merge fully into Para Police and Fire, and when they do so, we'll calculate what their remaining unfunded obligations are, and the city will continue to fund that. The City of Fairmont and its Police Relief Association had some analysis done before requesting the legislation and are aware of what it would cost them to continue to pay off their unfunded liability with a lower assumed rate of return. So they're going into this understanding what they will pay over a set period of time to pay off their unfunded liability once they merge with us.
When they are coming in, Ms. Vanek, what percent are they funded at typically, like Fairmont and Virginia?
Madam Chair, I don't recall the specific funded ratio, but they are very well funded. I believe Fairmont was in the high 80s, low 90 percentile range under our assumptions, and Virginia was very close. I think they were short, maybe about $6,000 in meeting their full funding requirement, and both groups are all benefit recipients, so there are no continuing active members, which is why the cities make the contributions to pay off the unfunded.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, perhaps you want to go through a few highlights of the bill for us. It's a thick packet. We wouldn't have time to do line by line, but if there's some other major policy decisions in here, maybe just touch on some of the additional highlights.
Madam Chair, looking first at the items that are of some potential financial or fiscal impact, I would draw your attention to two provisions. Article 2 does have some fiscal impact in the sense that it obligates Minnesota Management and Budget to put together a report largely generated from existing data provided by the pension plans and put it on its website relating to benefit contributions and contribution requirements. So this is a report that is not accompanied by an agency appropriation. The other fiscal item, as I can identify them, would be in Article 8 of the bill having to do with TRA. Most of this provision is moving language that used to be in another chapter, not the TRA chapter, related to the former Minneapolis teacher pension plan, which was consolidated into TRA in 2006, and moved some of its state aid and other local contribution requirements to the TRA law. In sections 4 and 5 of Article 8, there is a provision that has to do with there are deficiencies in those additional local contributions that were required to the old Minneapolis teachers and now TRA. There is an updating and a more vigorous, substantial recovery provision, which could provide some additional assets to TRA. So those are the two items that I can identify in the bill that have some fiscal impact. The plan, or the omnibus pension plan, omnibus pension bill this year does not contain a whole lot of controversy. Some significance, the original baseline bill has to do with the MSRS correctional plan. This is has to do with individuals who work in the Department of Corrections or in Human Services at St. Peter or the Sex Offender Program or the Extended Treatment Options Program. This does move some employees who are currently in the plan but who have taken different occupational classifications into the plan. It also clarifies the Extended Treatment Option Program, a DHS program that has been eliminated, and pending its our replacement, we've done the necessary renaming in the correctional plan to retain those individuals still working in what's left of that program in the correctional plan.
Mr. Martin, could you clarify for me again when you said, are you moving employees who have been reclassified into or out of a plan? Are they? I know that there are certain plans within the correctional system where people are allowed significantly earlier retirement. So are we getting more people into that program, or are they going the other way?
Madam Chair, this is that program that allows for early retirement. The individuals involved here are currently in occupational positions that are covered by the correctional plan. They're having their jobs changed to a different job name. And the way the correctional plan works is you have to be in a particular correctional institution and in a particular job that's designated in statute for coverage by the plan. There is some reworking of some occupational oppositions at St. Peter and at the sex offender program. And individuals who are being newly put into those new positions happen to be current covered employees in the plan. So they're retaining their coverage as they move to different positions that now have been determined to have sufficient inmate or patient contact to merit being in the plan. So there's no net increase in the number of people in the plan. Mm-hmm. It's a reshuffling of people based on changing occupational names and changing work duties.
But they still have sufficient contact with inmates to justify being in that plan.
Madam Chair, yes.
That is a significant benefit. I mean, mm-hmm. people get to retire significantly earlier if they're in that plan. And I know often I've seen in the past movements to put more people into that class or that plan, and I've questioned it because I have questioned whether or not their risk of working in the prison was significantly high enough to justify it.
And, Madam Chair, there is a process that the Pension Commission has put into place in the last several years where the agency does an initial job assessment for any oppositions that are suggested as being appropriately in the correctional plan. The results of that in-house process is then forwarded to the Pension Commission on a staffing level. I pursue those and attempt to validate to the extent that I can the findings of that recommendation process, and then the Pension Commission hears the bill. And this is the result of the most recent set of recommendations, only from Human Services and only including a few dozen employees who are actually in the plan currently and will end up in the plan at the end of this process.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair. You know, there were a number of changes made in 2010, and I know one time pensions were increasing by 11% or something several years, put a cap of 5%, and I think we lowered the minimum a little bit. Just at what levels of funding do we get the 2%, for example, and at what level does it ratchet up to 5%? Do you have to get to over 100% funding to get the 5%, or... Just how is that determined?
Senator Langseth, Madam Chair, the post-retirement adjustments are now set at a flat 2.5% when the plans are in good funding shape, and somewhat less than that when they're not in good shape. That was the function of the 2010 legislation. So MSRS plans are at a 2% increase until that plan becomes at least 90% funded on a market value of assets basis. PERA is somewhat lower. TRA went without post-retirement increases for 2 years and is lower than 2.5%. They all go back to 2.5% for the statewide plans once they reach the 90% fully funded basis. There are similar provisions for the two defined benefit local plans, major local plans, Duluth Teachers and St. Paul Teachers. There is a, since they're tied to the cost of living, when they're sufficiently well funded and the cost of living is sufficiently high, they could go as high as 5%. But they're less well funded at the moment, and the scaling in to get to anything like the 5% rate will requires very good funding and will be not attained for a while.
Yes, under the sheet that we have, members, the TRA is funded at almost 76% under the amended language that we just adopted, 85% for MSRS and 74% for PERA. So the only one that's even close is MSRS, which you indicated is getting a 2% return because they're closer to the 90%. I think this was what was challenged in court. We put that in 2010. It was challenged. It was upheld. There were a couple of states that ended up in the same position, and ours was upheld that it was legal to do that, is to cap those until we had a higher level of funding. And it was really a big victory for the state mm-hmm. that we were able to cap those COLAs, which, you know, allows us the freedom. If it ever goes even lower, you could freeze them at – well, we have frozen some at zero. And so we know that that's permissible if the funds get in worse shape.
Madam Chair, South Dakota and Colorado, too, did something very similar and was upheld. But, yeah, very monumental change.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, any other things you would like to point out?
Madam Chair, I would just point two other articles. Article 10 is the work of a working group that was assembled by the state auditor pursuant to a legislative mandate to revise the investment authority statutes applicable to both the State Board of Investment and to local plans. And this represents a resyncing up or a reconfiguration and added clarity for the investment authorization statutes for our various pension plans. And then Article 12, having to do with volunteer fire, largely represents the work of 2 years' worth of working groups assembled by the State Auditor's Office that meets with a large number of volunteer fire representatives and works out needed changes in the volunteer fire plan laws. And this is the results of the 2010-11 interim working group and the 2011-2012 interim working group. Mostly related to cleaning up filing requirements and also clarifying return to service authorization. Volunteer fire plans have found it necessary to attempt to reinduce retired firefighters to return to firefighting service in order to have sufficient personnel to conduct their tasks. And that's something that has been authorized, I think, by the 2009 legislature, and there's some tweaking of that language here. Madam Chair, with that, I think I've covered the major things that are in the bill.
Are there questions from members? Are there any further amendments?
No, Madam Chair, but Mr. Fleming, Morgan Fleming, would just like to say a few words, if possible.
Mr. Fleming?
Madam Chair, Morgan Fleming. I'm usually here on behalf of middle management or members, public employees. I'm here in his role as Moralton Management, was a structured finance entity. I'm here to talk about the unintended consequence of what you do here on the state's bonds, and I look at Senator Langseth because this won't be new to him. And Madam Chair, I know that from the Pew Foundation and Senator Bonhoff, on your travels, you hear these stories across the country. They're not so well known in Minnesota. So the work in 2010, I have a memorandum. If Jennifer want to pass it around, doesn't need to be read.
We have it in our packets, members.
Without the correcting amendment that you put on, that the good work of 2010, the $5.9 billion actuarial gain would have been halved to 2.9. The guess is now, without an actual run, that's $600 million consequence. The reason it's important, so important to your committee, the work that you did earlier to pass the ambition of a bonding bill, this is an offering statement of last fall's state bond sale, the $769 million bond sale. In it, it has an addendum that's 51 pages long called Appendix B that talks about state finances. 18 pages of that are about pensions, They talk about 2010 specifically. They talk about the performance of the SBI over 20 years being 5.4% above the CPI. So the nice result is that tranches of this sold for 2.8% last fall. And the people that bought the bond, well, J.P. Morgan bought one of the tranches, absolutely spent a lot of time understanding the pennies and the good health of the pension plan. And it has an impact on the interest rate in the state bonds. So that it's a good thing, and we get A reports in it. So thank you.
Okay. Senator Rosen, it is unusual that we have a pension bill with no funding required. So that
good work
is appreciated. I know every other year we have to make some contributions somewhere, but this is appreciated, and hopefully these policy changes will be beneficial to the funds. And then I think the study could prove to be highly beneficial, especially if we enact the recommendations that may come out of it later.
Madam Chair, I just would like to again thank the funds and everybody who cooperated and worked on this bill to move it forward. It was we worked very hard on it. So, and Mr. Martin, Mr. Burke also, and to everybody in the room here.
Okay, with that, is there a motion to approve the bill? Senator Goodwin moves that Senate File 1808 be recommended to pass and placed on general orders. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. Senate File 1808, as amended, will be placed on general orders.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Mm-hmm. The next bill up will be Senator Fishbach's bill, Senate File 1573. It's a higher ed omnibus bill. Senator Fishbach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand there is a fiscal note I have not seen. But my understanding of that is that it shows a zero. So
it's showing a zero,
and
Senator
so
Fishbach.
When the page gets the chance, I'd like to see a copy of it. But I do have, and I don't. There is a lot of policy in the bill, and there are several sections, which are sections 14 and 15. And I do have an amendment. Thank you very much. I have an amendment that would delete those. If you would like to do that first, it would delete those two sections that it was the provisions from Senate File 2423 that it was my bill that would have related to the leveraged equipment fund and in the Minsky program for workforce development. Those were the two funding issues.
Members, in your folder is the A5 amendment, which deletes sections 14 and 15, which are at the back of the bill and include two blank appropriations, which is why the fiscal note did not have a cost associated with it. But we did get a fiscal note because there's some fund money being switched around, being transferred. But it isn't a cost to the state.
And Madam Chair, I will just add that, yes, I am removing sections 14 and 15 out of this bill so that it can go onto the floor with no fiscal implications, but I'm not giving up on the programs. So I understand that it's possible to put those into another bill that, where we may be able to find a few dollars for it. So.
And Senator Fischbach, I saw some good news that the Minsky Board has decided to proceed with Section 15 without a separate appropriation. There was an article in the newspaper about this just the other day. So they are working to align their programs to meet the needs of Minnesota's employers and provide the skilled workforce that, that the employers are looking for. And I understand that they're undertaking that without further direction from us at this point. However, the amendment is also eliminating an appropriation for state or equipment that students could be trained on that would be very current equipment, and there is still some hope that we might find a tiny bit of money for this and put it into a different bill that will possibly move tomorrow or early next week as a tiny little supplemental budget bill.
And Madam Chair, it would allow those schools and Minsky to leverage what dollars we are able to increase those dollars, and so that they, I believe that the president was who spoke with me at higher ed said that it's 3-to-1 for every dollar that we get, they're able to leverage another 3.
Right. The business community is eager to have their students trained on the latest equipment, and oftentimes they're willing to contribute to that. But this would help match some of that money to get that new equipment into the. Into this, particularly the technical schools. So on the A5 amendment, Senator Fischbach moves that amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Senator Fischbach.
And Madam Chair, would you like me to go through the sections or just have the discussion? I mean, because there's a lot of policy here that doesn't involve dollars, and would you like me just to go through those sections? Because the one that kind of prompted the fiscal note is a Senator Tomasoni. It's Section 8. It's Senator Tomasoni language from Senate File 1799.
Yes, we'll need an explanation of that, please.
You know what? I will, if whatever you'd like. If you'd like me to go through the whole bill or just those areas.
It's not a very long bill, so if you could just briefly touch on the different sections, it won't take long.
Sections 1 through 3, Madam Chair, of the the bill reflect a Senator Carlson bill, which relates to the textbooks, and it aims to provide students with more information regarding required and recommended course materials. Sections 4 and 5 are the language from another Carlson bill, which is the which would allow Minsky to continue operation in case of a government shutdown. Section 6 is from one of the bills that I have that raises the bonding authority for Minsky, the Minsky Revenue Fund, from its current level from $300 million to $405 million that they request. They requested a little bit more than that, but we brought it down to $405.
Senator Fischbach, could you just explain what that fund is used for?
Maybe, you know what, it is for, I'll just have Jason come up and explain all that. He'll do a better job, I'm sure of it.
Good morning.
Good morning. Madam Chair and members, Jason Fossum, the Committee Administrator for Higher Ed. And the Minsky Revenue Fund is a internal mechanism that the system has that allows its campuses to build revenue-generating facilities on campuses such as residence halls, student centers, parking ramps, parking lots, residence halls, things like that, that they can use then the revenue from the project to pay off the bonds.
Thank you. And I understand there's a need for some dormitory remodeling in particular.
And Madam Chair, I will say that Mr. Fossum did a better job than I would have done. It was much clearer than I would have been able to explain it. So that is Section 6. Section 7 was a request from the Office of Higher Ed. It just really is some clarification language regarding the account owner for a Minnesota Savings College or Minnesota College Savings Plan. Section 8 is the Senator Tomasoni language, and this changes how the dollars within the Permanent University Fund are allocated and would funnel some of the dollars into a fund to establish an engineering program at the Mesabi Range Community and Technical College. There is an additional provision that was not in the original in his original bill that caps the amount of the scholarship a student receives while attending the new program at $6,500 per year. And I believe, Madam Chair, you are interested in that provision. Section 9 is some clarification language from Senator Pappas, which grandfathers a very small number of institutions who were caught up in some unintended consequences of a language change a few years ago. It's the institution versus college and how they can use that name. Sections 10 and 11 are a Senator Vanderveer bill, which expands the eligibility for safety officer survivor program for use in graduate programs, and the effective date is retroactive to July 1st, 2011, to allow several individuals to access those benefits. Section 12 is the working group language from the textbook bill of Senator Carlson's, so that there would be a working group set up. And finally, Section 13 deals with it's a Senator Rest bill that deals with the transfer of money for the graduate medical education from the University of Minnesota to the Hennepin County Medical Center. And I think there was several, actually, Senator Rest bill is the actual one we ended up hearing, but I believe there was several bills that reflected that same intent to have the U transfer that money. And then, as we did in the amendments, Sections 14 and 15 were deleted.
Are there any questions? Senator Stump?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On Section 13, what is the kind of the basis for that transfer?
Senator Fischbach?
And Madam Chair, Senator Stump, it was a Senator Rest bill, but my understanding is that the university was no longer making those payments to the Hennepin County Medical Center for that program, for the family medicine education program, and so Hennepin County needed to come to the legislature in order to get the university to transfer those funds and continue funding that program.
Is the Madam Chair, is the university in agreement with this, or?
Yes.
Well, Madam Chair, I believe the university there may be representatives from the university here if they would like to speak to that.
Would someone from the U of M like to come forward to comment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Fitzgerald. I'm Chief Financial Officer at the University of Minnesota. This particular issue has a long history. As you know, the state specials where this appropriation has come in previous years, over the years, those have been consolidated down into a larger appropriation with particular language about what is a eligible expenditure from that appropriation. The legislature on and off has included that particular language. This was one of them that as the state specials were cut in recent years, the appropriation was reduced. That particular line item was dropped out of the language, and the university, in trying to make up and balance its budget on those state specials, because we can't spend more than you appropriate, reduced that appropriation that's now being re-line itemed into the bill. We understand that this is a prerogative of the legislature to do this, and we do. While we, of course, would like to spend that money on something else, we understand and support this particular provision that's moving through the legislature.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, I have not been in committees where I've had a chance to learn much about the mineral lease. So this isn't to this testifier. He can go. So I've not learned much about the way the mineral lease money comes into existence, goes out, and so I was wondering if Senator Fischbach could just talk a little bit about Senator Tomasoni's provision, or if somebody else could.
And Madam Chair, I wish Fischbach. I could explain it better than I. So I will defer to the university to allow them to explain it.
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, PUF funds, as they're called, are, in this particular provision, mineral royalties on state trust lands flow to the University of Minnesota on our trust lands, controlled by legislation. In current law, 50% of those royalty mineral payments go to an endowment that benefits NRRI, Natural Resource Research Institute in Duluth, 50%, up to $50 million. The other 50% in current law goes to an endowed scholarship account that is referred to at the university as the Iron Range Scholarship Program that benefits about 1,400 Minnesota resident undergraduates who get a scholarship out of that endowment. The legislation changes that flow where it directs, and it's a fortunate situation in that there was a substantial increase in mineral resources this past year. And NRRI will hit that $50 million cap this coming year.
Okay.
Under current law, 100% of that would then go to the endowment, because the cap's been reached on the NRRI endowment. This legislation takes what really was flowing to NRRI, directs it to the new endowment for the engineering program, and so 25% of the 100% will flow there now, and 75% will flow to the scholarship account. And the university does support the change. Okay. We feel it's a reasonable level.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Bonner,
can you distinguish between these trust lands and the trust lands that are used for the K-12?
Yeah, they're
Mr. Fitzenreiter.
They are different lands given to the state for a different purpose, and the money flows different directions. What we're talking about here is just the trust lands for the University of Minnesota.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, and I'm so grateful that you're here, because
I
wasn't aware how all that went. What is the comparison in terms of acreage and perhaps return on the investment from the university trust lands and the trust lands that go for K-12?
Madam Chair, I don't know the mix on the acreage.
And the, Madam Chair, the ROI, how about the return?
When this money is distributed, the minerals, and there's also state forest land, but that goes to a different account. The mining minerals are distributed to the university. The university then invests those dollars and manages the investment in its books at the university. And the payout on these endowments, because we consider them true endowments, is 4.5% a year of a trailing 30-month market value of the endowment. It's a trailing average to take the highs and lows on investments out. That's how we administer the money.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Bonner.
Does anybody here know what the trailing average would be on the trust lands for the K-12 system? Do we have that comparison? Does anyone have that?
We can get it, Senator Bonner.
I would like to see that. Thank you. Okay. And thank you very much for that information.
Thank you very much.
Senator Tomasoni wants to make sure that we have students who are trained to deal with mining operations. As there apparently is a demand for skilled workers in that area, and that's what part of this is set up to address.
And Madam Chair, if there are no further questions, I guess I would move Senate File 1573 as amended to the floor.
On that motion, that Senate File 1573 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Senate File 1573 will be placed on general orders. And next up we have Senator Peterson with Senate File 1922.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Good morning.
Good morning. We have today we have before you Senate File 1922 relating specifically to excuse me, to rules and how our state agencies look at rules. This is a complicated issue, as many of you already know, and so I'd hope to kind of start out by talking to you a little bit about why we're trying to address this this situation, because oftentimes elected officials, I believe, are routinely and regularly held responsible for the rules that come out of state agencies. So I think we have some bipartisan agreement on this issue. In particular, I would ask you to please note Senator Bach and Senator Tomasoni are also co-authors on this bill. And I think that problem is also magnified by the number of bills we've had introduced relating specifically to rules this year in the legislature. This bill would simply require the agencies to update rules review report that the legislature required of them a decade ago in the year 2000. And I have some information about that. If folks have questions about that, I can try and address those specifically. But in short, what this bill would do would require agencies to submit rulemaking documents to the chairs of the standing committees through the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and then also assess the cumulative effects that result in the impact of a rule in addition to other rules adopted in the state, including federal rules and relating specifically to the SONAR, which is a statement of need and reasonableness. With that, Madam Chair, members, I certainly would work to address any questions.
Senator Peterson, did you want to move the A6 amendment? We have an amendment in our folder.
Yes, Madam Chair, I do. I apologize. I would do that at this point. Ask a committee member.
Senator Langseth moves the A6 amendment. Do you want to give some explanation, Senator Peterson?
Sure. Much of the conversation, that a presentation I just gave you, addressed the changes. This bill has really the work of really almost 2 years now modifying.
Excuse me one moment, Madam Chair. I don't have a copy of the amendment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was in our folder. You may go ahead, Senator Peterson.
So, Madam Chair, members, the amendment basically makes the rule changes. It's changed significantly from the last committee. Basically, originally we had asked all state agencies to do this rule review, and now we've changed that so that just really three agencies are affected: the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Ag, and the Pollution Control Agency is the other critical part of this amendment.
Senator Goodwin? Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, have you checked this amendment out with the Department of Labor and Industry? Or is there anybody here that can speak to this amendment?
Is there anyone who wants to testify for or against the amendment?
What is this doing? Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, I think your bill was pretty non-controversial, and I don't know whether this changes that or not, but I sure would like to hear from somebody that may know if this changes the amount of controversy in your bill.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, I have not talked to the Department of Labor recently, so.
Senator Goodwin?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, where did this amendment come from then?
This amendment basically is an effort to continue to peel back and address some of the opposition we've heard from state agencies. In fact, I was just looking through the record. What this bill, Senator Goodwin, is doing, some on this committee may remember, and I was just looking to see if you were on the record or on the record of this bill that was passed back in 2000, Senator Goodwin, that basically the legislature asked the state agencies to do exactly what this amendment is in terms of reviewing the rules before they would actually go into effect. And but so from the Department of Labor, to answer your question, no, they haven't. But the amendment is an effort to try and address concerns from state agencies, I think.
Oh.
Senator Goodwin.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Peterson, I heard that the Department of Labor and Industry might have some issues with this, and I don't know if they've been able to really see it yet, but I'd like to know.
Senator Goodwin, I think this was added as an amendment to the House bill as well, and I think that's already out there. I'm pretty sure. Senator Peterson, can you confirm or not?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is a same amendment in the House. I was just checking to see if. Oh, yep, we have Mr. Brzezowski here from the Department of Labor.
Okay.
Would you
like to identify yourself, please?
Madam Chair, it's a member of the committee. My name is Lisa Frenette. I'm with Frenette Legislative Advisors, and I've been working with Senator Peterson and other members of the legislature on this bill over the course of the past few weeks. What the amendment does real quickly is we took out some sections that were controversial, including allowing for standing committees and the Legislative Coordinating Commission to take a look at rules before they were promulgated. Currently, you have the ability to do that after they're promulgated, but we had thought that maybe since a lot of legislators talked about the fact that they had problems with constituents who hadn't heard about the rules, that they would like to see the rules before they were promulgated. That's been taken out. We also took out the sections that were controversial in terms of how much money or the fiscal note cost, which was through the Sunset Advisory Committee. So the Department of Education's taken out, Department of Labor and Industry's taken out. I don't have everything in front of me right now, so I'm sorry. Department of Health is taken out, Department of Human Services. So we've been able to greatly bring down the cost of the fiscal note. And that's what's left over then is the Environmental Agency's report, which was done 10 years ago. Many of you voted for this 10 years ago, and we're just asking for an update from some of those agencies on where their rules are and what they've done.
Any further questions? Yes. Senator Higgins, you have a puzzled expression.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, where is the provision that makes us a full-time legislature? If you're all going to sit around and, you know, dork around with all the rules that our professional employees work on, you're going to be here night and day all dang year. And, you know, this is
Madam Chair,
professional staff who know what they're doing.
Senator Higgins, I think that was eliminated.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And Senator Higgins, that was a message I got loud and clear, and to accommodate those obstacles, quite frankly, we have removed that from the bill. So
the full-time legislature?
Yes.
No.
No, that was never in there, sorry.
Good luck on that.
That was never in there, but much of the additional work, for example, originally in the bill, it would have asked state agencies to go back and review all local ordinances as well. Yeah. Which was a major concern, which we took that out. So I would say a lot of the work that was originally addressed has been removed.
But, Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins.
Senator Peterson, you still seem to have that the agencies every year in January have to tell you everything they're going to do or that they did the year before. Which is that?
Ms. Frenette,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Higgins, this is a rulemaking docket that the agencies currently have to post on their website. Simply what we've done, because legislators have said we don't know what rules are being promulgated and what's happening, they have to bring it to the standing committee. It's their rule docket that they already have
to have in place, and if you guys want to look at it, you have the ability, and if you don't want to look at it, you don't have to look at it. Just gives you guys the ability to look at the docket of what rules they want to promulgate or what they've done for the past year, which is currently on a website, is to be sent to the standing committees. And, again, you have the decision whether or not you want to look to see if you want to look at it. And it addresses, again, concerns that many committees have heard over constituents or with constituents who have said, we had no idea that this was happening. We didn't know what was going on. And it gives you guys a chance just to look at the docket, not every rule. Not every chapter rule is just a chance to look at the docket if you'd like to.
And Senator Higgins, Senator Lilly had a bill which I was heard in some committees, and maybe you heard it, and that was the one that had the complete moratorium on rulemaking. So this is a very much modified version of giving legislators a kind of a upfront look at what might be coming. It is not stopping them from doing any rulemaking.
But Madam Chair, if it's already on a website, I think we're all pretty computer literate, to some fashion anyway. You know, if somebody's interested in this, go look at the website. Why are we doing this? I know you've pared this down, but there's still just, micromanagement is the word that keeps popping into my brain. And I just think, you know, it's a solution in search of a problem.
Does someone want to respond?
Madam Chair and members, I can repeat the problem, you know, that I started with, is that routinely I think elected officials are absolutely held responsible for rules that are produced by state agencies. And Madam Chair and members, this is just simply an effort to give those elected officials a chance to review them one more time before they actually go into effect and have cumulative effects on the folks that live in Minnesota, quite frankly, I think it is a reasonable request. So.
It is true that once rules are put in place, they basically have the effect of law, and so I guess it could be helpful for us to review those again before they even get. This would be asking them to put them out even before they do the rulemaking process or just before they take effect.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it does not ask them to put them out before they're promulgated. We had a provision in the bill at one time that asked them to do that. What this simply does is say, you've got a rulemaking docket that's online, or they already have to have it online or have a rulemaking docket. Present the docket, which says what rules you're thinking about promulgating or what rules may have been promulgated over the year, just for the standing committees to look at. And if they have a question, then they can bring it up even further through current statutes in the APA.
Okay, I understand. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'll ask Senator Peterson, what impact does this have on the board advisory opinions?
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, I would have to ask for a little more explanation in regard to specifically their duties. Is there a particular rule or decisions that they make that you're concerned about?
No, I'm concerned about what this amendment will do to their opinions.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, may I ask, are you looking at the guidelines section? Or what specific area are you looking at?
Just the amendment in general.
It shouldn't affect advisory opinions at all. I think you're thinking through maybe the campaign finance board, although we currently have in statute, and what this does is it reinforces that if you have a guideline or a policy out there, you can't enforce it unless it's been part of a rule, and that's currently law right now.
Well, Madam Chair, then
Senator Goodwin,
I don't understand why we need this. If what you're saying is that this is basically currently law and we passed it in 2000, I'm confused. I just would like an explanation.
We passed. They gave us a report in 2000, but it isn't current law. The report was issued then. Ms. Frenette?
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin and members, I'm a little confused at what you're looking for, Senator Goodwin, so I'm trying to figure out what I'm addressing. What we're asking for is in 2000, there was legislation that many people here supported that asked for an update of rule reports from various agencies. So we're asking for an update from the environmental agencies, and what this does is it dovetails actually with two other initiatives that are going on right now. There's an appropriation that was given to the PCA along with the University of Minnesota to report on water quality rules. There is a an executive order from the government from the governor on environmental review from last fall asking them to update on rules. So we thought what would be nice is if we brought all the rules forward that the environmental agencies had, because people talk about duplication and redundancy in rules a lot. I found out when I kind of started this a couple years ago that there was several areas within the DNR, the PCA, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources, for example, where they were all doing stormwater rules and nobody was really talking to each other, and there was a lot of duplication and redundancy. We've had developers and people out in the community who are trying to do things. One in the Minnetonka, Wayzata area where they had 50 permits for a development. 20 of them were water quality-related rules from the Army Corps engineer all the way down to the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District. And nobody knew exactly what they were supposed to do, and everyone was trying to find a reasonable solution and trying to do what they were supposed to do that was right. But one body would walk on to a development and say, well, you need to do it this way. And then another agency would walk on, so you need to do it this way. So what we're looking for with bringing this rural review report together is where's their duplication and redundancy and how can we make it more efficient? So that's what this report does.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I'm asking so many questions.
That's okay.
But I get highly suspicious when at the last end of the trail here, and we've got a bill that's agreed on by all the parties that are interested, and suddenly we get an amendment on that bill, whether or not this went into the House or not. It wasn't heard here in the Senate on the original bill. So I know changes, this amendment was not part of that, or it wouldn't be here today. So then I get interested in what's going on again, because we've got too much divisive legislation going on around here, and it would be nice if we have a piece here that is not divisive. So I really would like to hear from the department on the issue.
Mr. Rutusky.
Madam Chair and Senator Goodwin, I think you'd be better served to hear from the MPCA. The Department of Labor and Industry hasn't been tracking this bill since we've been exempted out of it.
Okay.
He's here.
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. Mr. Kodelka.
Hello, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kodelka. I'm the legislative director with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And there are a number of agencies. I know that the Commissioner of Agriculture had sent a letter out to folks with concerns on the bill as it was before amended here. We do appreciate a number of the changes made in the bill with this delete all amendment, removing some of the other requirements that would add fiscal costs to it. However, we still have agencies beyond Pollution Control Agency, DNR, AAG, and others still have concerns with a number of policy and fiscal ramifications of this language. And if since this is the Finance Committee, I'll just stick to the finance pieces. At right now, when we're looking at the languages here, we do have some concern dealing with the Section 4, dealing with the cumulative effects piece of this. The way it's written, there are some questions on, well, excuse me, let me back up a little bit here. There's a new number 8 in the bill. There are some requirements just a little bit above that number 7 between existing federal regulations that are specifically on the topic, but the definition of cumulative effects has a much broader scope. One example in our agency deals with hazardous waste, medical waste, as we deal on the disposal side of it once it gets to a landfill. However, up the chain of control of that issue, that is handled by a number of additional agencies that could have an impact on that. Us then having to do a cumulative effect on how a hospital handles their medical waste, or how it's then MnDOT regulates how they transport hazardous waste before it gets to the landfill, does add a number of pieces to us, which would add cost to our fiscal fiscal cost to us preparing the sonar, which this is a part of. There are other pieces too, rules that deal with how electricity is handled, ratepayers questions that a PUC handles, But for PCA and some of our air permits, if we were to make a change, that additional information would have to be pulled into the calculation. Another fiscal concern is Section 5 dealing with reports. We do appreciate the changes made by the author on this. This is a more streamlined report than what was originally in the bill. It is closer to that was passed in 2000. The large difference here, though, is in 2000, when a similar report was requested, the agencies, the PCA had until 2003, 3 years to complete the report. This report would be due by the beginning of next year, a much more compact time frame to go through and find the number of changes between what also has changed on the federal level between now and then, according to this report. So there are some concerns about the additional resources that would need to be made to meet that timeline.
Senator Peterson, did you want to address that issue?
I can wait till Madam Chair and members. I'll wait. Madam Chair and members, I'll wait till he's completed, and then I'll address his concerns.
Mr. Delka.
Chair and committee members, that's the fiscal concerns I'd like to highlight at this point.
Mr. Kadelka, but I guess it kind of surprises me that as you put together rules, you don't currently consider the accumulative effect of them. I guess that's what we're hearing from some of our constituents is that's the problem. No one is looking at that, and the cumulative effect is overwhelming sometimes and sometimes nonsensical to them. And so I would think that would be part of the process on a regular basis. So I don't understand why it would be an additional cost. I mean, I would assume that should be part of what they look at when they're developing rules.
Chair and committee members, we do some of that work. However, the way this language is written is quite expansive. Areas we wouldn't. For instance, if right now we are working on some mercury rules for facilities and their mercury emissions, we do look at what other requirements are done on the federal level on that. However, on some of our rules, there are much more expansive looking into the case, again, going back to waste. The way this is written, all other rules that affect that waste through its chain of command, even though we may not personally have any authority over it, would have to be looked at. There is some concern on what that does to the scope from a number of agencies on how that does do it. We do some work with comparisons to other places. For instance, last year under House File 1 and the executive order from the governor, PCA on any rules that we have to go through in our sonar, we have to compare rules to all the states in surrounding Minnesota, all the states in the same EPA Region 5, which includes Great Lakes states, and federal rules. So there is some of that work being done. You are correct, but this expands it beyond that, and that's our fiscal concern.
Senator Higgins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kadelka, could you satisfy the notice to the legislature provision in here by just sending the chairs and the ranking members a link to your website? Because I think you could. Send them an email with a link to your website.
Mr. Kadelka.
Chair and committee members, that could be one option. I know on right now, with each of our rulemaking, when we do send out the sonar and the draft rules, we send those to the chairs. We could send out a link. That's not one of the fiscal items we have a concern about. But you're correct. Each agency has a docket on their website that's updated very often, more so than once a year, that has a detailed description of where we are in the process with each of our rulemaking.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for our testifier here, I have a question. Who are you representing in this?
Ms. Burnett.
Madam Chair, Committee Member Senator Goodwin, I'm here pro bono. I have worked on similar stuff over the past few years. Senator Peterson and Representative Beard, who have worked on it, along with Lloyd Grooms, had asked if we would continue to work on stuff with them.
A straight up question. Are you working for the American Chemistry Council?
Madam Chair, committee members, I do represent the American Chemistry Council, but not on this issue. I represent them on another regulatory issue dealing with energy codes.
Madam Chair,
Senator Goodwin.
I really think this is becoming a bill that we really have to take a second look at. And I don't see the agreement here, and I would like very much to see agreement on a bill here for a change and send it back to make sure all the parties that are interested in this have something. So I'm going to make a motion to table this for now and send it back to the committee it came from so people have a, and I don't know what committee that was, but maybe Commerce or
on that motion. All in favor of Senator Ingebrigtsen?
It's not debatable.
Okay.
On the motion to table?
I need a question. Are we tabling or are we sending it back to another committee? There are two things that were mentioned.
Madam Chair, I'd make a motion to send it back to the committee it came from.
Oh, Madam Chair, is that a debatable motion?
That's debatable.
That would be debatable. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Madam Chair, thank you. And the question I have is, have you talked to Senator Tomasoni and Senator Bach about the amendment?
Senator Peterson.
Yes, Madam Chair, members. Yes, they are aware of the amendment. And specifically, you know, Madam Chair, members, you know, I do have to take issue that the argument that this has not gone through the committee process. I would argue I had asked for help on this issue basically because of the problem statement I've given you twice now. I have absolutely been held responsible for rules that I have had no opportunity to have an input on as an elected official. And that's the problem we're trying to address that we started really last session. And it's been through the committee process, two committees just this session alone, and has ended up here. That argument, from my perspective, is not valid. And the authors are aware, specifically relating to the cumulative effect, that is a term that comes right out of the environmental review language, which is already in law. And what this amendment does is help clarify that definition, I believe, for state agencies. I understand they may have some concerns, but it helps clarify that definition. And then relating specifically to the report that we're referencing that was from 10, specifically the PCA spent less than $10,000. It was $9,600 to produce that report 10 years ago. I understand labor has gone up and the cost of staffing and copying and all those types of things. But this, members, this is a report that already exists and just simply needs to be updated. So I think it was fairly reasonable request when this report cost less than $10,000 to produce 10 years ago to start with a report that's already there and then begin to take a look at the rules that have happened between now and then. And so I would certainly ask Senator Goodwin to reconsider her motion and move the bill
Senator
to the floor.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up with that. And so I guess I have to agree. Senator Peterson's put a lot of work into this, and to Senator Goodwin's point that we have to have both sides buy in on this. You've got now the minority leader as well as a veteran senator that agrees with this and wants to move it forward. I don't know what more agreement you would need than that, so I would ask members to vote against the Goodwin Amendment.
Senator Goodwin.
Madam Chair, I'll change that then to a motion to table it here until some of that gets worked out.
On the motion to table.
Madam Chair,
Senator
members,
Peterson.
Senator Goodwin, what would you like to see worked out specifically?
That I know that there's agreement on this between the agencies and some of the other shareholders and the stakeholders in this, I mean.
No, we won't have any further discussion. Okay, if you vote for the amendment, it goes on the table. If not, we'll continue with our discussion.
Can I have a roll call vote, Madam Chair?
Roll call has been requested. On the motion to table.
Senator Bonhoff?
No.
Senator Cohen?
Yes.
Senator Fischbach? Senator Goodwin?
Oh, yes, yes. I would say yes.
Senator Hahn?
No.
Senator Higgins?
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
No.
Senator Langseth?
No.
Senator Magnus?
No.
Senator Newman?
No.
Senator Nenow?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Perry?
No.
Senator Stumpf?
No.
Chair Roebling?
No. So we're still on the A6 amendment. Is there any more discussion on it? I think that we need a motion. I think Senator Langs
moved.
Did
roll on the motion. It was a roll.
My constituents.
You didn't tell us. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, on a vote of 3-11, the motion does not prevail.
Gotcha. Madam Chair.
Senator Stump.
Madam Chair, just where does the Board of Soil and Water come in terms of the fiscal note?
Senator Peterson.
Madam Chair, I'll defer to Ms. Frenetti on this question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Stump, the Board of Water and Soil Resources has not submitted a fiscal note on this. I have.
Any other questions about the amendment? I think Senator Langseth had moved the A6 amendment earlier. Is that right? Yes. Senator Langseth moves the A6 amendment. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. And so to the bill, are there any final questions or comments? Anyone else who wanted to testify for or against? If not,
I'd move Senate File 1922 be recommended.
Excuse me, there's somebody coming up. You have to move quickly or wave your arm or something.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly towards this bill. My name is Betsy Hayes. I work for the Department of Administration. I'm a contracts manager in the Materials Management Division. And I just wanted to speak very briefly. Admin was one of the divisions that, or the departments that submitted a fiscal note on this matter. And it pertains primarily to what is in Amendment 2 as Section 2. And this was, I believe, a section that was alluded to previously by Senator Goodwin. In reviewing the bill, believe that this provision, amending and adding Subdivision 1A, heightens greatly the obligation in our department to prompt a proactive approach to really look at every guideline and manual, SWIFT procedures, things where in the Department of Administration, especially in the procurement area, we have many, many guidelines and policies and so forth that we think would need to be looked at very carefully. And so that's really the height or the heart of our fiscal note is to incur a few individuals and a support level staff to take a look and make sure that we don't have these types of policies, procedures that should be rule. And we just wanted to make note that the amendments made to the bill wouldn't impact or remove that provision that was the heart of our fiscal note.
Senator Peterson.
Yep, Madam Chair and members, I think that that issue or that paragraph or her testimony kind of reiterates the point you made about many rules are considered law and when they're really not in terms of those guidelines. And if they need to do that relating to unadopted rules specifically, yeah, if they need to do that, then I think, this committee, I think that confirms that that there may be some overstepping, some bounds in that area. So
the division, this section is pretty clear that if it is not a rule but it's a policy guideline or other non-binding interpretive statement, that it not be considered a rule. Otherwise, there could be it couldn't be enforced.
Yeah. Madam Chair and members, that portion or that subsection A under Section 2 in the amendment is already in statute. It's Statute 14.381 titled Unadopted Rules, which that language comes directly out of current statute.
Right, and I guess guidelines, we like to suggest people follow them, but if they aren't adopted as rule, I can understand why it might be difficult to enforce them. If they're really important, then they probably have to be moved into the rule category if that is deemed necessary, and go through the rulemaking process. Senator Bana?
Madam Chair, I'm confused still by with the conversation, and partly I'm sure it was because I had stepped out, but what is the current fiscal note total for what's before us?
I think I'm not sure if this is the fiscal note done to the amendment or not.
Right. No.
I don't think so.
No, it isn't.
Because it has all the agencies in it.
So what is the total amount that we're looking at?
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, yeah, we don't have the current fiscal note with the amendment yet. So,
the goal was, though, of adopting the amendment was to get rid of most of the fiscal note, but understanding that there's still some agencies that are affected. But, you know, yesterday we were in the Rules Committee, and Senator Metzen gave a little speech, which I think everyone in that room concurred with, that he's wondering why every time we do anything, we have another half-time employee added, another full-time employee added, and we keep adding. And he said there might be 800 people in the agency or the department, and we're giving them a little more work, and we're asking them to reprioritize. I'm giving Senator Metzen's speech here. And then instead of using the existing staff, a request is put in for new staff. And I guess that's kind of a decision we have to make with this bill in particular, is that do we ask existing staff to prioritize this in some way so that we can get this information? And it's not as extensive as it started out by any means with the amendment. Or do we really believe we need to add more staffing to do it? And I guess this chair is of the opinion that these are things that probably should have been done in the first place, and we need to ask the agencies just to do them. And sometimes they accept that, as management and budget did in one other instance earlier this year, and sometimes they really wanted more staff, and I don't know that there's a lot of us that are willing to do that. Senator Goodwin?
Well, Madam Chair, I think I can help explain that a little bit. Since they've been getting cut so much, they've cut their staff, and in the meantime, we're throwing all these extra mandates on them and expecting them to be able to do that along with their regular work. So I just think that's pretty understandable if you know what the situation is in the agencies and how few staff they're operating with now and how many different duties they're doing. But you don't, obviously. And so now we come to the problem that we have a bill in front of us that has an additional amendment to it that we don't have a clean fiscal note on. And now we're expected to send this to the floor. And this committee is the one that's supposed to come up with the cleanest fiscal amendment we can come, or fiscal note that we can come up with. And obviously we're not doing that, so this bill is not ready to go to the floor.
Well, Senator Goodwin, this has been worked on for quite some time, and what remains are things that I think many of us, and we'll tell here soon by a vote, believe that these are things the agency should be doing, and probably always should have been, to give us information and give the public information, and that it falls under the current purview of their jobs. So, Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, a couple of things, kind of variation on the theme. I can give Senator Goodwin's speech about where we are with agencies and in terms of cutbacks and responsibilities and so on. But just in terms of the process, this bill comes in front of the committee with a fiscal note that reflects apparently a total of it looks like about 1.7 million for. No, for the rest of the biennium, about 1 million. And then for the next biennium, about 1.4 million. Now, apparently the amendment cuts back on that significantly. Madam Chair, if the committee wants to send the bill out without a fiscal note and with no fiscal impact, that's one thing. But if we assume there's a fiscal impact, then there has to be a tracking of that. And if the amendment has changed the fiscal note significantly, shouldn't we lay the bill over until tomorrow so we can at least know what the impact is on the budget? Obviously, we've been dealing with the state budget, because if, in fact, there's a cost to the general fund, then is that money coming from the reserve? Is that money coming from Senator Olson's bill, the education bill? at least in terms of the process, we should have a sense of what we're tracking. If the committee's decision is that there's not a fiscal impact, that the monies, that any responsibility for this amendment will be taken out of existing funds, that's one thing. And that should be then stated clearly in the amendment. If, however, it's assumed there's a cost, we should at least have a sense of the cost. So my concern is just in terms of the process and in terms of tracking dollars. So, again, as to my second point, whether I agree or not, if the wish of the majority of the committee is that this is to be done out of existing revenue, existing staff complement, then we should at least have some indication of that from the author, from the chair. Do it by language so we have no question.
Senator Cohen, I think it's been done that way. I mean, it's been done in the past, and by simply not appropriating more money, they know it comes out of the existing budget. Okay.
And so, Madam Chair, just because we have a fiscal note previously, prior to the amendment, that indicates the cost, I just want to make sure that then it's the position of Senator Peterson, Madam Chair, yourself as chairman of the committee, that this is to be done out of the existing staff complement, the existing appropriation for the impacted agencies.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, in line 3.30 of the amendment, that is our intention. We just simply ask that the cost of preparing the report be absorbed within funds that are already appropriated. So that's made clear. Answering Senator Cohen's question.
Senator Perry, did you have a comment?
No, I was just thinking, I thought maybe we might be ready to move the bill.
Is there anyone else who had any questions or amendments? If not, Senator Perry, Senator Cohen?
Senator, this is just an aside. I indicated the other day that you had adopted some of our bad habits, but not our good habits. And so this is more common. But one of the things we were often criticized for was we just passed bill after bill after bill after bill. And I'm wondering if there's a possibility we could get a running total of one regime versus the other in terms of number of bills passed.
I think we're still way under.
I'm not so sure.
We could get a running total. I think we might be surprised. Senator Perry moves.
I'd move Senate file number 1922 be recommended to pass and, I believe, sent to the floor.
That's correct.
I'm sure I'd like placed roll
on
call.
General orders. Senator Goodwin requests a roll call on Senator Perry's motion that Senate file 1922 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on general orders.
Senator Bonhoff.
Yes.
Senator Cohen.
No.
Senator Fischbach. Senator Goodwin.
No.
Senator Hahn.
Yes.
Senator Higgins.
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Yes.
Senator Langseth.
Yes.
Senator Magnus.
Yes.
Senator Newman.
Yes.
Senator Nienau.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Senator Stumpf?
Yes.
Chair Roebling?
Yes. On a vote of 11-3, the motion does prevail, and Senate file 1922 will be placed on general orders. And Senator Peterson, you may stay right there.
Okay.
You have the next bill as well, 2324.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate file 2324. Is one that absolutely has the collaboration that I think some of the members of your committee were asking for and looking for in a bill. This bill relates specifically to installation of satellite systems. It currently has the support of Mr. Bill Haney, Government Affairs Director for the IBEW, that's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Also, Mr. Gary Thaden, representative of the National Electrical and Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association. Mr. Haney just clarified that they're neutral, but they were absolutely involved in the conversation. And then also the Department of Labor, who has been involved in this conversation. You'll see that the fiscal note offers a savings to the agency because of the changes. And what this bill does specifically, it establishes two new electrical-related licenses. These licenses are for satellite system contractors and satellite system installers. And this regulatory authority will be administered by the Department of Labor. Essentially, what was happening here, these satellite installers who deal with low voltage wiring were being brought into having to learn and pass and the full electrical code test. Some examples of some of the type of operations they were having to learn about and were things like refrigeration, burglar systems, things that have high voltage wiring and which they never deal with and don't deal with. And so this is just an effort to carve out an exemption for these satellite installers in the bill that we have before you today.
Thank you, Senator Pearson. There aren't any questions. I'm told that someone would like to speak to this. Please come to the table. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is William Brown. I hold two occupational licenses from the state of Minnesota. I'm both a power-limited technician, someone who's currently licensed to supervise satellite installers. I'm also a licensed firefighter. I have my Master's in Business Administration from the Carlson School of the University of Minnesota. And really what we're dealing with here are two issues. We have about 250,000 lightning strikes in Minnesota every year. Of that, we have about $5 million in structural losses, buildings that burned down, 250 fires caused by these fires. And there's an issue about the code written by the National Fire Protection Association, Code 70, known as the National Electric Code, that when an installation is done, it is practically safe. So we're having 250 fires a year. When the Department of Labor and Industry went out and audited the satellite industry and the installations, they found a third of the installations are unsafe. So under current practices, a third of the installations are unsafe. So what we're proposing is, in this legislation, is to take the experience requirements and move them to zero, and take the education requirements and move them to a one-day online class that you can take. Now, let's look at really what's happening here. From a finance standpoint, is we're trying to take employees and move them to contractors. We're trying to eliminate our workman's comp premiums. We're trying to eliminate our unemployment expenses. We're trying to eliminate our Social Security, our FICA contributions, because from a finance standpoint, there are only two satellite companies that are selling direct broadcast. One of them made $4 billion last year. That's with a B, $4 billion. And they made $4 billion. And if they had one person working for them, they could legally have all their employees installing satellite dishes across the state of Minnesota with no additional licenses. There are 7,000 people in Minnesota who already have these licenses who could go to work for this company. So we have a solution in search of a problem. We don't really have a lack of installers. Best Buy Company is one of the licensed contractors. Best Buy has one employee. All that employee needs is 3 years of experience, and they need to pass a three-hour test. Best Buy did that, so every employee, and that's a key distinction here, every employee for Best Buy can actually go out and install satellite dishes. So why are we changing the law? Because the company that made $4 billion only wants to pay $65 to have someone come out, gas, truck, tools, a person, come out to your house, pay for cable, wiring, install the system, train the user, and theoretically do this safely. Realizing it's a $65 flat amount, so every time they put a lightning protector in, that's less money that they make. So when we're in a situation where right now Best Buy can install, there's 1,500 companies in Minnesota already licensed to do these installations. We don't have a problem. What we have is a problem that you can't find somebody. We in statute have found that $80 an hour is a reasonable fee for the electrical inspector who would inspect this kind of an installation. That's $80 an hour. And now you're looking at a 2-, 3-, 4-hour installation that you're going to pay $65 less the cost of materials, the cable, the clips. That's why the Department of Labor themselves have found such a high rate of dangerous installations. So would your mother be sleeping in a house done by an installer with no experience and one day of training? Do you want your child? Do you want your neighbor who do you really want in here? Now, the senator implied that the Department of Labor was in favor of this. I got an email yesterday from the Department of Labor saying that they're neutral on it. They have taken no position on this legislation. What we're really doing is we're codifying in statute a revolving door, because the people who are taking this and illegally installing right now don't realize they can't make money at $65 an hour. So they take it, they work for a few months doing this, then they realize that they're losing money, and they leave the industry. You can't get 3 years of experience. And in the testimony previously provided, that was the issue in the previous committee. This is not a lack of installer issue. If we do this, the price of satellite doesn't come down. If we don't do this, it's not that people don't get their satellite installation done. It's the company that made $4 billion may not be able to buy those installations for $65 each. And what we're changing here, we're codifying, we're blessing, is a transition. A transition where that person who should be installing should be an employee. They should have workman's comp in case they're hurt, so it's not a welfare role or it's not a Medicaid payment for their injuries, because these people do get hurt. One of the installers had dozens of people electrically hurt last year, hit by lightning, electrocuted by high-voltage electricity, working on roofs, falling off roofs. Well, what we're really seeing here is we have two companies that are selling this, just two companies, and now we're codifying in statute that we're going to have all these installers separately moving around. It's like going to a picnic, and now we're going to try and stamp every ant at the picnic, rather than really looking at the enforcement issue that relates back to how this equipment is being subcontracted. Because in statute currently, it is not legal to offer an electrical installation unless you have a license. And if we enforce the laws that are currently on the books, and again, the company that's making $4 billion, if they want a subcontract, there's 1,500 companies in Minnesota that can do it already, including Best Buy. So we have legislation that's in search of a problem that doesn't actually exist in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chair and members, I can repeat my problem statement again for you if you'd like. The problem is, we have contractors. These are small business persons that are involved in the installation and sale of satellite television systems in Minnesota, and they're being asked to pass a test that would allow them to install swimming pools, fire alarms, outdoor lighting, refrigeration, air conditioning, central heating, air conditioning. All these things far exceed the skills and the knowledge required to install a low-voltage satellite system. And that's who approached me with this. I'm not sure who these other organizations are, but I was approached by small business people that are trying to make a living and feel that the state has a licensing system in place that far exceeds what they need to have done. And like I said, as I stated earlier, the Department of Labor, the IBEW, as well as the Mechanical Electrical Contractors Association are all neutral on this bill. They've been involved in this process as it's moved forward to, again, its last stop here in front of the Finance Committee.
Any questions? Senator Magnus.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, could I put my own satellite dish up with this?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Magnus, yes, you could.
You put mine up, too.
Well, Chairman, I'd for less than $80 an hour, I'd, maybe 75, I'll come over and do your thing. I'm going to be retired. I'm going to need the income.
Senator Perry? No other questions. Is there a motion?
I'd move Senate file number 2324 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Senator Perry moves that Senate file 2324 be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor. Is there discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill's passed.
Senator Nelson has been patiently waiting, and we have Not too much time left, Senator Nelson, so I hope you have all the kinks out of this one.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I know you've had a full morning already. I will try and be brief. Fast, I hear. Madam Chair, might I start?
Please do.
All right. Thank you for hearing Senate File 1650 on government efficiency. Today's hearing is a chance to explore issues around how to make government work even better for its people. And this is, I think I'll just be really brief, maybe, Madam Chair, in explaining what this bill does. And then if you'd like my testifier, I'll bring her forward. But Senate File 1650 requires administration to make available a master contract program to assist agencies in using data analytics to reorganize agencies along service lines and to reorganize management functions. Reports are required on January 15 of 2013 and 2014 regarding use of the program, efficiencies achieved, and the contract oversight process. You might recall that last year, Senate File 907, we used analytics in four areas: smart buildings, fleet management, Medicaid and tax fraud detection and prevention. Those were passed into law. The governor also expanded upon that, and in his data analytics master contract program, took those areas along with other areas and has implemented this analytic technology as far as making government more streamlined and efficient. This initiative proposes to just further expand that that data analytics into the areas of government efficiency. That would be things like what are agency core activities, what services should be shared across agencies and departments. Can it be at a lower cost? Is there overlap? Is there duplication? And while we might have policy differences on the question of what are our state funding priorities, I do know there's one area that we all can find common ground in, and that is our desire to be the best stewards of the tax dollars that we can. And using data analytics to analyze a government organization can help do that. That means that we want to ensure that the appropriations provided by this legislature are used in the most efficient ways to deliver services and public goods to our residents. By looking hard for operational improvements and thinking carefully about the design of agencies, this body can play an important role in driving real improvements in our government and in the lives of Minnesotans. Madam Chair, I almost feel like I'm not sure if the committee wanted to hear this bill or not. There's a little conflict on the fiscal note. The fiscal note says it would cost $1,000. To do this. However, if you read on the inside, it says that the agency can absorb the cost with those two reports. Yep. And furthermore, I'm so glad, Madam Chair, that you made the Metzen speech, because I heard that yesterday as well, and that was going to be my speech as well. So if you like, Madam Chair, I do have someone who can give the committee a broader overview of what this data analytics looks like and why this study is a good idea.
Senator Bonna.
Madam Chair, I'm fine with the bill. We are working on this, and I actually, Senator Daley's trying to get before the Finance Committee to present his benchmarking request, because we think that the most comprehensive approach isn't to do just this bill or that bill, but Senator Daley's bill says that we need to look at every back office function across all agencies and assess what the cost that we're paying is versus best practices compared to other states and other private businesses and public companies, and then look where we're below average, and that's kind of our menu of opportunity in terms of having a strategic plan for going at this reorg systematically. So I think this is fine. I'd support it, but I think it's really important that we not leave this session without just at least committing to that benchmarking approach.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, and along those lines, on lines 13 and 14 of the bill, what on earth does optimizing the span of control ratios to public and private sector industry benchmarks mean?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins, I had to ask that exact same question. I understand everything in this bill except that phrase. And
I
will paraphrase.
Delete it now?
No, it's a good thing. I will paraphrase, but we might have Nancy Hilden come up to explain it in more detail if you like. My understanding is it has to do with making, and it kind of explains it, I think, in the next phrase, making decisions closer to those who are involved. It has to do with kind of leveling out management and bureaucracy, or at least looking at those ratios. The ratio is, you know, how big is the management compared to the rest of the department. So it has to do with kind of flattening the organizational structure. Would you like more information on that? If so, I'll call up my testifier.
No, we've run out of time. So,
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, if I could just address Senator Bonoff's comment. That is a great bill, the Daley bill, as we've heard that in our government redesign and reform. And I will mention these are not contradictory bills. In fact, actually, this bill is a little bit broader than that, in that this study would incorporate all of the things that we talked about with office benchmarking standards in the back offices or any of the other things as well. So it's a very broad bill requiring using data analytics to better determine all government services. And the report will come before the legislature.
Senator Ingebertson.
Senate File 1650 to pass and move directly to the floor.
Is there anyone here who wanted to testify for or against the bill? If not, on Senator Ingebertson's motion that Senate File 1650 be recommended to pass and be placed on general orders, all in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee.
And with that, members, we are going to adjourn for today, but let me just announce, because in case you miss it on your schedule, tomorrow is the day we start at 8 o'clock.
I was here today. At
Senator Stump and
too.
Senator Higgins came today at 8. I'm sorry.
Late.
well, you were here at time.
How many bills do you have any idea tomorrow?